Right. Everybody ready? 1, 2, 3.
Tech Show rules!
It's a little thing tech show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that are linking bad. For the show, then go to DLNGS.org. And I see channels at LinuxLink.net. Bound tech show. Just sit right there, cause the castle's just about to begin.
So, guys, let's talk about those lottery numbers that are going to happen.
You guys playing lottery?
Wasn't it? I forgot to write them down.
Did you guys all just shut up after I had to reconnect again? Honest to goodness. Dave Yates.
If you just check the paper, I'll
start
with you.
Introduce our guest. Since you are the most familiar with Carol right now, introduce our guest and let's get to talking.
Okay, Carol Smith is program manager of Google Summer of Code and the Google Code Inn. And Carol, just we'll go around and introduce ourselves. You've talked to me before. I'm Dave.
Yep. Hi, everyone. I'm Carol.
Well, I'm Alan.
Hi, Carol. I'm
the quiet one. So I'm the one you'll never hear from again. Now that we're doing an interview.
Hi, Pat.
God, we're really bad at introducing ourselves.
Anyway, Carol, I guess you can probably tell we're not the best in the world at introductions, but I think you're here tonight to talk about Google Code Inn.
Yes, I am. Yes. How should I proceed? Would you guys like to ask me questions, or do you want me to just kind of go into my spiel about the contest?
Well, okay, yeah.
What
let's,
is the contest?
Let's have you go into your spiel about the contest.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I had to step away for a second, so I didn't hear Dave Yates finish introducing you, because I smelled oil. And when there's an oil smell and kids running around, somebody's up to no good.
Well, it's good you went and checked on that.
So tell us about this project coming up.
Yeah, so actually, starting this Monday, I know that your listeners are not going to probably hear this until after the contest has already started, but starting this Monday, November 22nd, we're launching our program for 13 to 18-year-olds to participate in a program that is designed to basically get our mentoring organizations, of whom there are 20 open-source software mentoring organizations. They're going to be creating tasks for all these students to work on. And during the contest period, the students are going to have an opportunity to work on all sorts of kinds of tasks. They're going to be things ranging from coding and programming to outreach type stuff like creating videos and marketing materials and logos to doing translating documents to making new documents for the organizations to doing research and UI design is going to be all sorts of stuff for them to work on. And we're going to be offering prizes for them for completing just one task during the contest period. They'll get a T-shirt and a certificate of completion, of participation, I should say. For completing 3 tasks, they'll get $100, which is pretty nice. And they can get up to a maximum of $500. So they can complete 15 tasks and get $500. The other great thing about this is that there's going to be points associated with these tasks that the organizations are having them work on. And there are 10 people at the end of the contest with the most points. We're offering our grand prize, which is an all-expenses-paid trip to Mountain View headquarters, Google's headquarters, with them and a family member. And they'll get to attend an awards ceremony, and they'll get to meet our software engineers and hang out at Google for the day and get a tour. And they'll also get to probably go to Great America and ride some roller coasters and have some fun with us as well. So it's a pretty good contest. So it's going on for 6 weeks, from November 22nd until January 10th. And we're hoping that to get a lot of participation. We actually ran this program in 2007 under a different name. At the time, it was called the Google Highly Open Participation Contest, which is kind of a mouthful, which is why we renamed it to Google Code-In. And then we had 10 organizations participating, and now we have 20. So we're hoping that we get twice as many students. We had 400 students participating in 2007. We're hoping to get at least twice as many students participating this time around, if not more. I think that even more would be great. So that's kind of the deal on the contest. Do you guys have questions for me?
Yeah, that's open to 13 to 18.
I'm sorry. One at a time.
Go ahead, Peter. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Now, I was just wondering, sorry, if there was a web page we could go to and have a look at all this information.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So the web page where you can go to just get some more information would be code.google.com/G as in Gary, C as in Candy, I, GCI. And you can just get some
You're
more information.
Not very good at the phonetic alphabet.
Yeah, I'm not very good at the phonetic alphabet at all. Forgive me. So code.google.com/GCI is where you can just get some more information. If your listeners are actually interested in participating in the contest, they can go to google-melange.com. And that's where we're actually administering the contest from. We also have some mailing lists and stuff. I don't know how you'd like me to give you that kind of information, or if I should just kind of, if you guys can figure it out from the URLs.
No, go ahead. Just spit it out there.
Okay. So we have a couple Google groups as well. One is GCI-discuss@googlegroups.com, which is kind of our discussion list for the contest, and if your listeners are interested in talking to other participants or they have questions about the contest or anything like that, they can email that list. We also have GCI-announce@googlegroups.com, which is our announcement list, and that'll just be basically a very low traffic list. It's probably just going to be emails from me about things like when the contest starts, when we're getting close to some deadlines, when we've announced the winners, that sort of thing. So your listeners can check out either of those mailing lists and subscribe if they're interested in that as well. As well as administering GCI, I also administer the Google Summer of Code program. And so we have an IRC channel associated with Google Summer of Code. It's #GSOC. That's in Freenode. And if they want to head out into that IRC channel, we also have a lot of discussions going on about GCI right now because that's kind of the hot topic. So if they want to hang out in the IRC channel for GSOC, they can talk to people about GCI as well. So that's the whole bit.
Can you kind of walk us through a little bit that if somebody's interested in this,
mm-hmm.
What is it? So they go to sign up. What can they expect? Like, I mean, the information on google-melange.com mm-hmm. kind of gives you like a little taste. But I mean, so they go sign up, and then what happens? Do they get partnered with somebody, or do they have to choose a project or an area that they want to work on?
Yeah, so once the contest opens, unfortunately right now the contest isn't open, so there's not a lot to do on there except you can kind of look at our frequently asked questions. But once the contest is open, what you'll be able to do on that site is once you've signed in, on the left-hand side there will be a link that says List All Tasks. And there's also going to be a rankings list, but let me talk about List All Tasks first. So basically, you'll be able to click on that link, and you'll see basically everything that our participating organizations have listed that the students can work on. And there's going to be literally hundreds of tasks in there for the students to look at. And if you click on any of those tasks, like, for example, creating a video for KDE or doing terrain graphics for Battle for West Noth or whatever they choose to click on, whatever they click on, they'll get basically some more information about the task, which will be kind of a description of what they want the students to do on that task. They'll also get a difficulty level, so it could be easy, medium, or hard. They'll get a point level associated with that task, so it could be 1 point for an easy task, 2 points for a medium task, or 3 points, or sorry, 4 points for a hard task. And then they'll also get a duration associated with that task, so how long the organization thinks it'll take them to work on that. It could be anything from 48 hours to 2 weeks. So it's just whatever the organization has kind of decided is the right timeline for that. And then if they're interested in that task, if they look at that task and they say, you know, I want to work on this, there's going to be a link on that page to claim the task. And then basically, that's just basically kind of them raising their hand and saying, yes, this is something I want to work on. And then from there, the organization will let them claim it. And then they get to work on it. They basically get to spend their time doing whatever it is that is involved in the task. And from there, they can talk to the organization. I mean, this is really intended to be kind of a collaborative process. So we're hoping that the students will ask more questions either in the task dialog box, or they could potentially get on the mailing lists for these organizations or hang out in the IRC channels for these organizations. But whatever it is, we're hoping that they get more involved. I mean, the not-so-secret hope of this contest is that we get more developers into the open source world. But basically from there, they get to work on it. It's a pretty easy process to just claim a task and start chugging away on it. And then they have basically the duration, as I mentioned before, that's associated with the task to work on it. And they can spend their time doing that, and then they get to submit their work. And their submission can either be a URL to, you know, for example, a sample web page if they created a home page, or it could be, you know, a PDF of a document translation, or it could be one of many things. And then the organization will decide if they successfully completed it, and if the organization marks it successfully completed, they get the points associated with that task. And they'll be listed in our rankings. And they also get all the kudos that are associated with completing that task. So as I said, you know, completing one task will get them a T-shirt. Completing three tasks, $100, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the other thing is that all of these organizations are intended to be mentoring organizations for these students. So there's going to be mentors for all of these tasks. So if the students are working on something and they're a little confused, they don't know quite what they're supposed to be doing, they're always welcome to comment on the task and ask questions or speak to the mentor about the task and get more information if they need it. So hopefully this is kind of a collaborative process. I mean, this is what the open source community is really meant to be, is collaborative and communicative. So we're hoping that's what we're fostering here.
It's an awesome project. And,
you know, thank you.
It's Google Summer Code always looks... I wish I was a kid again. I didn't have any of this stuff.
I do too. I wish Summer of Code had existed when I was in college. I would have done Summer of Code instead of worked at the movie theater. I can tell you that.
So that's... I like the list of organizations you have contributing there, supporting. It's a really cool list.
We've got a whole bunch.
The contest is going, the time frame for this is November 22nd to January
10th.
What is it?
Yeah,
January
it's
10th.
Six, it's just about 6 weeks, yeah.
Now, does that allow like participants to be able to work on multiple projects, or is it just going to be a one-to-one ratio?
Yeah, no, we're hoping that they work on multiple things, and I think a lot of these tasks are going to be things that the students can complete in really just, you know, a day or two. There will be certainly things that take them, you know, a week or 2 weeks, but these are really intended to be short things. Like, for example, you know, I can think of one task they have that to create a two-minute promotional video for them. You know, that's the kind of thing that we're hoping that they can do in just a couple days. And then they can go on, they can submit that, and they can do a good job on that, and then they can go on to work on something else. So we are hoping that the students will work on multiple things during the contest period.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you won't actually know the participation numbers until the 22nd. Nobody can really do anything. Based upon, like, the previous Google Summers of Code, do you expect there to be, like, a lot of participation in here?
We're certainly hoping so. I'm trying to get the word out in as many places as I can, and this is intended to be a global program as well. Like I said, we had 400 students participate in 2007, and since we've doubled the number of organizations, we're hoping to at least double the number of participants. So I'd like to see it at least at 800. But honestly, yeah, to tell you the truth, I won't know until the contest opens. So we'll see, but we're certainly hoping so.
What percentage of those participants would fall in the 13 to 14-year-old category? Like, that seems pretty young to me to start coding, but...
You mean the participants from 2007?
Well, yeah, like, yeah. Like, and what would you expect this year? Like, do you get a lot of really young kids? Like, to me, 13 is pretty young. Getting involved in this, or the majority 17 and 18-year-olds?
Well, I actually think that the most important thing about this contest is getting them started young. I think getting student developers interested in open source software and interested in working in online communities early is probably the best. So I actually don't honestly know the numbers of 13s and 14-year-olds that participated in 2007, but truth be told, I hope that there are majority younger students. I think that would be a win for everybody, because get them hooked early on open source, and
yeah,
that's a good thing.
That's true. Yeah, it can't be a bad thing, can it?
Yes, exactly.
Are they teaching programming kids that age in schools at the moment? Like, it's been 30 years or 40 years since I went to school, so...
In the States, I have to admit, it's not quite as good. Our computer classes, by and large, are kind of lacking, actually. I think most of the computer classes in the States are electives, and they're not required. And a lot of the students are learning proprietary software, even if they are taking computer classes. So I don't know what it's like in other countries. So I would actually be curious to hear about that, if you guys have more information about that. But I know that in the States, it's really kind of a sad state of affairs, and hopefully we're doing a little bit to improve it. But there could be a lot more done, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think in Australia it's pretty well the same as over there, from what I've seen.
Yeah.
Limited.
You know. Now, is Caffeine Ninja, are you still on?
Of course I am.
Do you have any insight as to how things are working over in Italy?
I do.
With regards to that question?
Yes.
So how's it going,
okay,
sir?
Okay, just kidding. No, my son just went into his first year of high school. Over here, they make you choose more or less a major as you enter high school. And one of them, for example, my son is going into Informatica Telecomunicazioni, which is just what it sounds like. And there he's already getting instructions. Now, a lot of the, in computer science, now a lot of the stuff what he's getting is very basic. It's only a little bit better than application training. But I have to say, the teacher, because our house is completely open source, we said we can't support a Microsoft-driven agenda here, and she said that was no problem because they were using only open source applications, so they're using only, they're training only on Firefox and OpenOffice and things of this nature.
Wow. That's awesome.
But they don't, as students, the average age, I mean, it's going to be freshmen, exact same age as a freshman high school student in the States is where they start doing this sort of thing. They rolled out here in my region, which is on the island of Sardinia, they rolled out a connectivity program for all classrooms, or all, sorry, all schools, middle and high schools. And that was incorporated connectivity back to a national internet service provider and a computer lab. So little birdies tell me that the computer labs in the middle schools are not being harnessed as much as they probably could or should, but they're there. And it's not, it's only in the high schools that have a specific program for computers and telecommunications where they're studying, to which, actually, my next question would be for you, Carol. Applying for, I'm reading the rules and I can see all the places where definitely you cannot participate. At what point would an applicant discover that he or she lives in a country where they can or cannot participate?
The countries that we are not allowing to participate are the sort of, quote, embargoed countries from the U.S. So countries like Iran and Cuba, and the full list is available in the rules, but there's only a few of them. I think North Korea, Iran, Cuba, Syria, and I think there's a couple others that I'm forgetting, but you can check them out on the, yes, thank you, Sudan and Burma, thank you, and you can check them out online. But besides that, besides those, yes, everyone else is good, exactly.
Because I will be sure to scream from the rooftops over here.
Yeah, please do. I would love you to scream from the rooftops. And if you could video yourself, that would be awesome as well.
If I could inject my experience in the K through 12 computer environment, education environment, because I worked in a school district, and I do keep a little bit of eye on what's going on in my kids' school districts with regards to this. The school district I worked in, I think, had a little better program than a lot of the other school districts. Granted, it was on Windows machines, and they did do some programming in Visual Basic, but they also did a lot of programming in Java, and the teacher was interested in open source solutions and using open source solutions too, introducing the students to that. And he was, you know, he was pretty good at that. Still, it was not a required course, so to speak, and it was only like, I think there was one or two different courses that were offered, and it was more on like an elective basis where you could choose like woodshop or computer programming. So not all the students went through it. But more often what I see and have seen, starting from the middle school grades, which I'd say like sixth grade on up through being a senior, the focus on what was required to be taken was more or less learning how to type, learning how to use word processing and PowerPoints and spreadsheet, kind of office-type applications, and going on from there. Not much in the way of programming, and more often than not, it was focused around a Microsoft curriculum.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that happen a lot in the States. It's sort of the elective, and even if you do take it as a class, it's all the Microsoft suite, basically.
Now, interesting question, and I don't know if you have an answer to this, or maybe you can give your thoughts, because, I mean, you're involved with Google and a lot of this education. When I was in school, in high school, and then into college, a lot of programming started, you know, the teaching of engineering students in college, and still a little bit in high school, if you did get a programming class, you were learning Fortran as an introductory language, and that has since graduated to Java. And kind of like a fork here of question, one is, do we see any Python being adopted in that role as to being an introductory language for teaching students. And the other side is I just finished reading a book. Link, are you still on?
Yes, I am.
Darn it, what was that book that you you hooked me up with? It's really good.
That programming book. Oh, boy.
Yeah, hold on. I'm going to bring it up because I just finished reading it a couple weeks ago, and I wrote a review on it. And one of the things that was listed that he made a point to make in this book, which is called Glitch, The Hidden Impact of Faulty Software by Jeff Papaus. Great book. Mm-hmm. But he had said that in the next decade, what we're going to see is some serious problems, particularly for banks, hospitals, you know, large corporations that are using mainframes, because they are still on those old mainframes that are running Fortran-based applications, and there's a very serious shortage of Fortran programmers.
Oh, interesting. Oh. Well, okay, so I guess in regard to your first question, the only places, at least in the States that I've heard of, that are doing sort of Python programming and are kind of advancing beyond the Visual Basic and the Microsoft suite are advanced placement computer science classes that are happening in the States. I know that there are some classes that are teaching Python and Java and trying to kind of move outside the bounds of the typical sort of just word processing and Access database kind of stuff. That's certainly the only place I've heard of in the States and sort of the general high school curriculum. In terms of the Fortran stuff, I'm actually not really sure. That's a really interesting question. I'd be curious to hear if any of you other guys have any insight into that.
No, they're all retards. They don't know anything.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, no.
I'm not a programmer.
Probably the guy to ask who is gone now was Pat, because he deals a lot of financial institutions and stuff like that. And his wife was, if I'm not mistaken, programmed on the mainframes, and now he's gone. But that's one of the things that I had read.
Well, I, you know what I can say that's not directly related to the Fortran stuff is that I know that we've seen a lot of startling statistics about the fact that we're going to, you know, in the 10-year and the 15-year, even in the 20-year time frame, we're going to have many, many more jobs in the computer science and engineering industries than we have applicants. And that based on the number of students who are majoring in computer science and the number of students who are basically going into any kind of computer engineering degrees right now, it's not in any way going to be able to keep pace with the number of jobs that we're going to have available in that industry. And that's pretty startling. And we need to do whatever we can to get more students interested in computer science, specifically females, but even the male population. The numbers are pretty startling, as I said. So anything we can do to encourage more students to go into computer science and engineering is a good thing.
Maybe I should be more up on this, but I'm not. Where are students going? Like, what are the fields that, you know, American students are going into, or are they not?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a case of they're not. I mean, I don't know the numbers specifically, so don't quote me on this, but I think that the problem is a lot of students aren't even going into, you know, it's actually interesting. I've heard kind of differing opinions on this. Some statistics are saying that more students are dropping out and not going to college in the first place. And then I've also heard some statistics on the other side that we're getting more applicants to the top universities than we've ever seen before, and that we can't even handle the load on the colleges. And yet, none of them are going into computer science. It's kind of a strange dichotomy. I'm not sure what to do with that information, but I'm hoping that we get more 13 to 18 year olds at least involved in open source software and programming. That's for sure.
I know when I was up in the Lehigh Valley, we were going to the Lehigh Valley Linux Users Group. Was for a while there, it was at Moravian Academy, and the guy who secured that location for us was a professor of computer science, and he had mentioned on several occasions that the quality of students coming into the computer science department was steadily degrading, in that they were not at all prepared for what a computer science degree entailed right there, because he said that...
I think one of the words he used was abysmal,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was abysmal, because he was saying they came in expecting to kind of do the same stuff that they were doing in, like, Visual Basic and everything in their computer classes, and they were just not at all prepared. They couldn't get through simple logic problems or anything.
But they walked in there, and he didn't even have any, you know, Windows there. He was using Java stations, Sun Java stations, right?
Yeah, they had Solaris, Spark and stations. I think they were running BSD too.
Mm-hmm.
In some places.
Yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of different things. I actually spent 2 weeks traveling the country and talking to high schools about GCI, about the contest, trying to get more students involved. I've heard a lot of teachers say that it's hard to keep up the curriculum, to keep up with the way that the computer industry and the internet are moving these days. Or specifically that they don't really have a curriculum, and that the government really hasn't provided much of a curriculum in the first place for them to teach from. And then if they have a curriculum that, again, it's, you know, the students take it as an elective course, and that a lot of students aren't even really interested in the first place, which all of it is very frightening. Are you guys familiar with teaching open source, the sort of collaborative group? I'm sure you probably are, but they're trying to create sort of an open source, basically a book, a manual that they can use in colleges to teach open source and computer science curriculum. And I think this is a really great effort. I'm hoping it gets more traction. That is certainly one effort that's trying. I would love my not so secret plan to take over the world is to make it such that any student who majors in computer science in any university can minor or have an emphasis in open source software. I think that would be a great thing, but I don't know that it'll ever happen. But it's just one of those things that I'm hoping I could actually accomplish.
Is teaching open source targeting colleges, university level, not...
Yes, yeah, it is. It's both, but specifically the manual that they're trying to create, the guide, is specifically designed to be taught in classrooms in universities.
Yeah, because one of the things that strikes me initially when looking at that, teaching open source, is it's a twofold problem I've heard in the K-12 environment in particular, is that if you don't have the resources, source material, textbooks, you know, stuff like that, a curriculum-based instruction be available for the teachers, they're not going to use it, you know, they're not going to be able to use it, or it might not even be able to be adopted in the environment unless it's approved by some standards organizations. So you have that going against it, but at the same time, if you go to develop a curriculum resources and tools, you're bucking up against the institutions that supply those. And
yeah,
that's a whole other chain of bureaucracy and competition that, you know, those textbooks that come out, those textbooks geared towards business computing and everything, they're written by companies that get some, you know, collaboration, a lot of them with Microsoft, that it's a huge financial industry right there, so they're making big bucks off of it.
Yeah.
They're going to receive opposition from, it's a twofold opposition there against open source in the curriculum.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, and computer science is such an interesting industry because it kind of goes exactly in the face of the way that we kind of teach in universities, in America at least, these days. And, you know, whereas math never changes, computer science is constantly changing, and programming is constantly changing, and new languages are being created, and the Internet is constantly evolving, and I don't think that really our curriculums can keep up with that. And we kind of need to re-envision the entire way that we teach in universities and certain and in, as well in high schools and junior highs.
Another thing that I see, particularly around here in Virginia, and I know it happens up north, if I'm not mistaken, to a little extent, is there's a huge, huge push for the standardized testing. Particularly with the No Child Left Behind, that there is a huge focus on the reading, writing, mathematics to get the 3 or 4 R's, whatever it is, that there's more of a focus in making sure students are prepared to pass those tests as opposed to the other things. They take priority over music and art and gym and probably the computer sciences and home economics and woodshop and everything, that there's more of a focus on those and making sure students are passing the tests as opposed to getting a well-rounded curriculum, which I think is kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think certainly members of the government recognize that there's a problem, and what they're trying to do is kind of this back-to-basics approach. And unfortunately, it means that they're taking out a lot of the things like you said, like arts and the computer sciences and you know all of the things that they consider the sort of soft skills. That I don't know that I consider them soft skills, unfortunately.
It's sad. Peter, are you still on?
Yeah, Dan.
Do you see the same things over there in Australia?
Well, to be totally honest with you, Dan...
Do you have computers there?
I haven't been to school for bloody 40 years, and my daughter's only 8, so I probably will start to see the same stuff a little later on. But, in my daughter's school, it's all Microsoft stuff.
But I mean,
the problem with open source software is like a cartel, Dan. Haven't I told you?
Oh, yeah.
It should be taxed to support the bloody closed platforms. We all know that.
Yeah. But do they have, like, do you have computer labs in your daughter's school?
Yeah, there is. They have a, well, there was that big push to put a laptop in the hands of every child in high school over here. And the government paid... Well, originally I think they were going to pay for it all, but they ended up paying, I think, 50% or something. So there was a big push. So it's not too bad, really, considering I saw a Texas Instrument programmable calculator, I recall, when I went to school. That was the closest I ever got to a computer. But, yeah.
Texas Instrument calculator.
Put that. Did you have one of them? I mean, don't forget, I used to use odd rules. But
let me guess, yours wasn't battery powered; it was plugged in, wasn't it? They didn't have batteries back then.
No. There was also that push to have fibre to every house. However, with the change of government now, I think they're going for a sort of mixed bag of Wi-Fi and copper and optical fibre, which is a pity because I think they bought all the trenches back off Telstra for about $11 billion from what I understood. So they've paid all that money and now it's going to go to waste, which is ironic since they sold it off, 10 or 15 years ago for God knows how many billion, and then they bought it back for 3 times what they got for it originally.
Somebody made a lot of government. Money off of that deal.
Yeah, of course. But it certainly wasn't the Australian taxpayer. Yeah.
Carol,
no, but I do think the government does see that, you know, that they do need to invest money in technology over here, and that they do try. But it's not open source.
Carol, I don't know if you had caught what Peter had said at the beginning there, and it's kind of not necessarily related to what we're talking about, but there was an article put out by these guys on Vox, which is Vox is a website of research-based policy analysis and commentary from leading economists, and this is the voxeu.org, and they had put out an article called Open versus Closed Source Software, The Quest for Balance, and in it they talked about how to have a balance of open and closed source software, and what happens, you know, what to be considered when there isn't a balance, when in one region open source software is greater than closed source, or vice versa. And they were talking about how governments need to be aware of open source and be able to figure out ways that they can influence open source software like they can closed source software, which is kind of the implication but never said. And they warned against open source software being the majority adoption in there, and talked about how it can result in becoming a cartel of open source software, locking people in. And one of their suggestions, which was quite humorous, here it is. One obvious solution to promote open source software, CSS development, in markets that appear to be locked in is and have remained CSS or OSS for a long time. These interventions will have to be made on a case-by-case basis. Wait, did I miss the cartel one? Okay.
It's down a healthy mix.
Yeah, one of the things that they suggest, a detailed analysis suggests that the best solution would be to tax OSS firms and use the funds to provide tax breaks for closed source software firms.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
funny,
a
when you were
we had.
When you were talking about cartels, I assumed that you had misspoken about open source and that you were talking about closed source. Like,
I'm actually glad Dad went and explained exactly what I was talking about, because people would have thought I was a big idiot tonight. But yeah, we found it interesting when we read that story the other day.
I'm having trouble sort of wrapping my head around the idea of open source software being a cartel. Like, isn't that the way we kind of envision closed source software right now?
Well, We're all a cartel.
Okay.
Here's what they say. In the article, it says, furthermore, Von Engelhardt and Maurer, 2010, provide an important clue to choosing this mix. They point out that the existence of CSS code increases OSS output and vice versa. To see why, consider an all-OSS world in which each company offers consumers exactly the same shared code as every other company. By definition, no company can then compete by writing more OSS code than its rivals. This lack of competition suppresses code production for the same reason that cartels suppress output.
Well, but isn't that kind of the point of open source software, is that they create sort of a competition in the marketplace, and so therefore everyone is inspired to innovate more and to create a better product for the consumer? Isn't that kind of the whole point?
Open source stifles innovation. Damn, you've been hard.
I'm sorry, I must have been mistaken about this whole open source thing.
Well, think about it, Carol. If I am Company A and Company B, and we are producing, case in point, we are phone companies, and we're selling our phones with Android operating system on it.
Mm-hmm.
We're all using the same code base. What is in it for me to add or do more additions to the open source software of the Android base that I'm using when my competitor's not doing it? Why should I even bother, right? What benefit is that going to give me? Absolutely nothing. We're just going to all use the same stock Android and be happy with it. Isn't that the way it goes?
Well, that's interesting, because I think there's two things that are different in that scenario. The first is that there are multiple, I think, open source software projects that compete on this And there's lots of examples in this scenario. There's many CMS, open source software CMSs that are competing right now to create a better experience for the consumer. But even if that is the case, even if you are using exactly the same software, you still have the reason to create a better product for the consumer, because then you want the consumer to be your customer and not your competitors, right?
You
still want to innovate on it.
The easy answer would have just been to tell me I was wrong, because I don't agree with that at all. But, you know, because you're right. I think that is the same. Makes me wonder, do these guys even understand? Why they almost don't understand open source or whatever, you know, the open source business models, how they work.
I think they do understand it exactly, and I think that this is a clear example of what happens when a study is funded by Microsoft or some other closed source, company. You can pay somebody to say anything you want, and that's pretty much what they did, because it's
FUD?
Preposterous
FUD?
And ridiculous, you know.
The heck you say?
Yeah. Imagine that.
Do we know who actually funded the study?
Do we want to know? I mean...
Okay, just thought I'd ask.
Backing up a little bit to Carol's questions about where the college grads are going, I have to confess that as a hiring manager for a technical department, if I have two candidates that walk up to me, one with a brand new shiny CS degree and another one who has recent participation in Google Summer of Code and is involved in 3 ongoing open source projects and has never stepped foot on a college campus, I know that the kid with the CS degree got taught information that is at least 6 years out of date.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that kid who's never gone on the college campus is cutting edge.
Yeah, you know, that kid that participated in Summer of Code has had real-world experience working with an organization that has specific requirements for their project and can actually, you know, extract requirements and work on them and change in the midst of the project and all of that sort of stuff.
Exactly. So your college graduate with a CS degree is now bussing tables where my employee goes to eat lunch.
Yes.
Having just been through probably 30 rounds of interviews for different positions in my company lately, and like having sat in on the interviews, I can tell you that the pickings are slim.
Yeah, I think a lot of employers are saying that right now.
And I would have loved, I'd have done backflips. And if you've seen me before, you know that, you know, that's a gravitational impossibility. But I'd have done backflips to get some people in that really impressed me with some definitive open source knowledge and participation. That would have been great. There's a lot of paper cert people running around. And when you really start asking technical questions of people like that, they simply do not have any answers. You know?
Yeah.
It's the paper tiger syndrome. There's just nothing behind it.
Yeah, I think we're going to be seeing even more of that in the coming years, unfortunately, if we don't stop this tide of more students just getting degrees and not getting degrees in CS, not getting real world experience, you know, that sort of thing. So,
well, we all use computers. We'll just have to have somebody build a robot to manufacture the computers, fix the computers, and program for the computers, and then a robot to fix those robots.
Yes, that's the solution. Certainly that will work.
Does Google run any robotic programs?
I'm sorry, what?
Does Google run any robotic programs?
Well, we just actually, I don't know if you saw in the news, but they just had an article about a robotic car that we started. We have a car that can drive itself now.
Are you going to send that to pick up the winners?
No, we're not. But that would be awesome, wouldn't it?
That would be awesome.
No, we're not. But man, I would love that.
The only option is to pull up to the curb with the LED flash on the front and the kit, the Knight Rider theme song.
You know, that would be great. I would love that. I've never actually ridden in the car. I would love to even just ride in the car. That would be great, too.
Peter, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, Carol, you're what, the administrator or something of the Google Summer of Code
Correct.
Project. Is anything that springs to mind, like any successes that have come out of it that...
We've had a ton of successes. Angie Byron comes immediately to mind, who's now working for Drupal. She was coding in, I'm gonna say either 2005 or 2006. She had never worked with Drupal before, and she had very little experience with computers. And she participated in Google Summer of Code, worked on a project for Drupal, and now she is a paid developer for them. And she's doing amazing work in the internet industry, and specifically in open source software. And we have lots of stories like that. Our blog, actually, we have all of our open source organizations give a wrap up after the summer ends of all of their students, and we have lots of different explanations about all of the projects that have participated in the summer program and what they're going on to do, and if there were anything, it was anything particularly noteworthy about them. We had 1,026 students participate this year, which is just great. So,
yeah. Well done.
No, I was just looking at her Twitter, and she's even mentioned here that GitHub hired one of the GSOC students.
Yes. Yeah, all kinds of stuff like that. Just awesome stuff. We've heard about students who use the stipend that they got in Summer of Code to start their own business. We've had students who were hired at lots of organizations specifically because they had Google Summer of Code on their resume, as you were already alluding to, all kinds of stuff like that.
What would be the percentage of men to women who enter the coding world? Is it still a few women, a lot of women?
It's still pretty disparate, unfortunately. We had over 10% of women Summer of Coders this year, which is much better than the industry at large and still not that great at all. I can tell you that that was a great number for us this year, and it's not even reflective of the general population. So I would love to see more women participating. There's a lot of efforts going on right now to try and get more women involved in software and open source and in computer science. Some of them have been more successful than others. I was just at a conference, the Grace Hopper Conference, and there's a whole effort around the Anita Borg Institute that is trying to get more women involved in technology. It's been somewhat successful, and we're still working really hard on trying to get more women involved in technology, too.
What do you think the problem is, that women just don't see it as a viable path to
take? Well, I'm not sure in general. I can tell you my specific experience has been, I know that at least when I was in school, I personally had a lot of trouble with specifically the maths and the sciences, and felt like I wasn't getting it. I wasn't really, you know, it wasn't for me. My brain doesn't work that way, sort of stuff. And I've heard from my women friends that they've had a similar experience, and that can often be a barrier to getting into the technologies and sciences and math and engineering specifically. But to tell you the truth, I'm not sure. I don't know why women in general aren't more interested in technology and math and engineering and science. But I know that from personal experience, that was why I was. It was harder to get me into technology, but once I got a job at Google, I was much more interested in it. I can tell you that.
Yeah, interesting.
Both my daughters are doing really well in math and science. I just hope I would really love for them to get more into programming, and I do try and introduce it. And they pick it up a little bit. The youngest one, not as much. The older one is starting to do a lot more stuff. And I think, I look at it, and I haven't pushed it too hard, but just to get her using the computer and doing stuff like making videos and exploring the web and doing other things like that, I think is important. Because, when I grew up, my dad, I know one of the big things that, just about every geek that I know that's into computers loves games. My old man was a hard ass about that. He would not let me play games on my computers. He said if I wanted to play games, I had to program them, which was unfortunate. Good and bad at the same time. Well, everybody else was enjoying games. I didn't have any games to enjoy. But I think some of that kind of takes away some of the fun of computers if you don't get to experience that. You know?
I think I'm going to cry.
I don't know.
It scarred you for life, didn't it, Dan?
What's that?
I said it scarred you for life, obviously.
It did. It has.
Hey,
you know,
let's make it clear, Dan. It's all your fault because you've got girls. I've only got two boys. So if there's no girls going into IT, it's your fault.
You know, I liked computer games when I was growing up, but I have to tell you that the moment when I actually got really involved in computers was the day when I realized that I could write HTML and that I could look at the source code for a web page and I could replicate it and create my own web page. And that was really the aha moment for me, was being able to view the source of a web page. I spent hours writing HTML just because I thought this was the greatest thing ever. I could make my own thing on the internet, and that was just the most amazing moment for me. I think male, female, young, old, whatever. I think when you have that aha moment, whatever it is for you, when you realize that you can manipulate the computer, you can make the computer do what you want it to do, is really the moment when I think a lot of people get more interested and involved in it.
That's some good stuff. I don't know. Link, is your daughter going into programming?
Nope. She's looking at law and medicine and things like that.
Uh-oh.
Do you know why?
That's what she's interested in.
Okay.
A medical lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like money and power.
Money and power. Dave Yates, you got daughters, man. Are they programming
I think
yet?
It's more like she's more like criminal psychology and stuff she's interested in, so.
Not yet, Dan. I have mentioned to the oldest one twice that that I was wanting to teach her HTML. She wanted to know what that was. I told her she was automatically not interested. I think my youngest one, who is 8, will be the one that leans that direction, though. She's they both use Linux, but my youngest daughter is much more interested in technology things. I mean, there's two people that can fix my mother-in-law's TV when it breaks, me and my 8-year-old. So I think she's not afraid of technology.
Yeah, but Dave, aren't your daughters the ones you scarred for life by putting your server and fan-blowing madness in their rooms?
Actually, yeah, my 8-year-old is the one that has the web server in her room, so she's gotten used to it.
Sorry, man, didn't mean to call you out on that.
Wow. Carol, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Absolutely, yeah, no, it was a pleasure to be with you guys.
What I'm going to do for you, Carol, because I know you want to get the word out, I think we're going to release the episode a little early so it goes out for Monday. I don't think that's going to be a big issue.
Oh, that's great. So awesome.
I do want to get that off the road. It's very important. It's good stuff. So, and I can't let Dave Yates be the only one that breaks it. And I know we had you on the show a couple months ago before the Google Summer of Code, correct?
You had Leslie and I both on. We were in tandem. We were partners in crime. Yes, we were both together there. Yes.
So, you know, just keep in mind, anytime you want to, you know, release some information or stuff, we're always willing to help spread the word.
Oh, well, that would be great. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm definitely hoping to get as many people, as many students participating and as many people interested in this contest as possible. I would love to see all of the tasks in our contest claimed and all of the students working around the globe, around the clock on these projects, so... That's awesome.
Yeah. Excellent. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I don't think so. The contest starts at 0800 UTC on November 22nd and goes until January 10th. And you have to be between 13 and 18 to participate, and we'll have to have a parent's permission slip signed before we'll send you a T-shirt or any of your money. So, yeah, they'll get an email about that if they complete a task to have them fill out their permission slip. But that's it. Yeah, I think just more students participating and getting involved in open source would be awesome.
You want to give out the URLs one more time?
Sure, yeah, it's code.google.com/GCI is for more information and the list of the participating organizations. And google-melange, melange.com to actually participate in the contest. And you'll have to have a Gmail account, a Google account to participate to sign in. So you can actually create one from the sign-in web page if you need one, but you will have to have a Gmail account to participate. That's all.
Excellent. I thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Oh, pleasure is all ours, believe me. We love hearing about the stuff going on, and we love having people, you know, people from Google come on the show.
Absolutely. It was great talking to you guys.
Thank you very much. Anybody else have anything for the good of the cause?
No, thanks, Carol.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
Absolutely. Happy to be on the show. I'd love to talk to you guys again soon about, you know, whatever. Like
all
talking
right,
to you guys.
Thank you.
Go to school. Try to fit in. Get rejected, get rejected, get rejected, get rejected. Get join the club. Go out for the team. Get rejected, get rejected, get rejected, get rejected. I call her up. I ask her out. Get rejected, get rejected, get rejected, get rejected. I dare her. She flips me off.
Come one, come all. Listen and partake in an open, practical discussion of personal digital security rights and liberties.
Encrypt my who's? My what's in the clear?
I, Cafe Ninja, will spend time here and try to make sense, in layman's terms, of the digital landscape.
What do you mean that's not my data? I mean it.
Learn what's shaking and moving in the legal world of Oz that will affect the way you live. See if there are things that you can do to keep your stick out of the mud. While you don't need one to get in, it's fine if you have one for the Tinfoil Hat Show. Find out more at cafeninja.blogspot.com or the Fusion Podcast Network, FUZION.
Just because I ain't paranoid don't mean they ain't out to get me.
13 to 18-year-olds.
That's the age group of this contest.
13 to 18 year olds.
Yeah.
Listening to our shows?
Hey, sure.
All right. Yeah. I will be back in just a minute. Everything's going. I got to finish up in the other room, and then I will be right back.
Okay.
All right. Love you, Dave.
I love you, Dan.
Dave Yates. Dave Yates.
Guess what I bought today, Dan?
Let me guess. A fleshlight.
A flash.
Fleshlight. You don't know what a fleshlight is? You still there?
Yes.
Hold on. I'll put it in the IRC. Let me pull up a good one. You're breaking up on me, Dave Yates. Here you go. I should tiny URL this, but there's one.
That's a little different.
Oh, you looked it up?
No, the URL is a little descriptive.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It is. But let me put.
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't buy one of those.
It's a better one. You can get a better look at all the different kinds that they have for sale there.
Hold on a second. My phone's ringing. My other phone.
No, you can build your own. What will they think of next?
This will be a first. Guess what I'm doing now?
What?
I'm making cookies.
Oh, okay. That's a little different.
No, I'm not at the computer right now.
What did you get today? Or is it the cookies?
I got Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, did you see it?
No, I'm going to. I'm going to watch it tonight.
Oh, that's such a good movie.
I saw Fight Club for like $15, and I thought, well, do I get it and see it? Because I know that's one of my top five favorite right there. But I went ahead and got Scott Pilgrim. It better be better than Fight Club. Have you seen Fight Club, Ben?
Of course I've seen Fight Club.
It's a good movie, ain't it?
It is a really good movie. I want to read the book.
I didn't know there was a book.
Yeah, the Hold on. Wait. I'll tell you the name of the book just a second. Maybe the name of the book is Fight Club. Fight Club. It's, yeah. Chuck Palahniuk. Here's the Wikipedia page. He wrote that book. If you also... you've seen Moon, right?
Yeah.
Same guy.
Really? Same guy wrote that?
No, wait. No, not Moon. Not Moon. I'm sorry. Hold on. Choke. The same guy
I've not seen it. But Moon is similar if you think about it.
Well,
in the whole multiple personality schizophrenia. Well, that's not really multiple. That's cloning. But it was still sort of similar.
Yeah, what I got mixed up with was, if you've seen Moon... the same actor, the main actor that was in Moon.
Really? I like him. Sam Rockwell?
Sam Rockwell was in Choke. Choke was written by the same guy. I like Sam Rockwell. He's pretty good.
Did you see Confessions of a Dangerous Mind?
I'm trying to think. I might have.
Chuck Barris' story, based on his book, The Gong Show, Chuck Barris. Barris is, right?
Yeah, I do. I'm trying to think whether I saw that.
Chuck Barris wrote a book. Chuck Chuck Barris claimed that he was an assassin for the CIA or somebody in his book. And that's what this movie's about. I think George Clooney directed it. It's not a bad movie. Sam Rockwell did a great job.
Yeah, I did not see that. I do want to see that, though. There's that one.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
What's the one that's about... there's one that's about the guy who was in Hogan's Heroes.
Bob Crane.
Bob Crane. There's a movie about Bob Crane.
Yeah, he was a... He was a dirty SOB, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he was, wasn't he?
He wasn't an assassin, but...
No.
I didn't see yet.
He was a different kind of assassin there. Autofocus. That's right. That's the movie. I think I saw Autofocus.
Who was I've heard of Autofocus, but I've not seen it.
Yeah. No, Sam Rockwell in... Sam Rockwell's awesome. I like him.
Yeah, he's a good actor.
That was in 2002. Greg Kinnear. I'm pretty sure I did see Autofocus.
Yeah, Greg Kinnear's good, too.
Yeah, I like him. Rita Wilson.
He was, you saw As Good As It Gets, right? I mean, he was good in it. He's been good in a lot of movies, but...
Yeah, Greg Kinnear used to host, Talk Soup.
Yeah, he was host what?
He was the first host of Talk Soup.
Say it one more time, the first host of what?
Talk Soup.
Talk Soup, okay.
Do you know Talk Soup?
Yeah. Eat or whatever.
Yeah.
He's got that look.
Did I just hear somebody else on here?
Yeah.
Sounded like it.
Who's that?
Cafe Ninja.
Cafe
Ninja. You turn yourself up, sir?
Yeah.
All right, that's good. Cafe Ninja
aren't
does
you better.
What? Yeah, that's good. Aren't you what, Dave?
I was going to ask Captain Ninja, I've forgotten. I think, aren't you originally from, like, the southeastern United States?
Yes, sir.
Whereabouts?
Atlanta.
Okay, Atlanta.
I used to work at Mindspring, man.
That's right, Mindspring. We talked about that, about how good a place it was to work.
You sound so serious and somber.
It's late over there.
Yeah, you. Oh, are you trying to be quiet?
Phone again.
Also, yeah. I get worried about picking up my breathing. I'm a big nose breather.
That's okay. You listen to the audio on this show. Either way, stick that microphone right up your nose. You know what? You might get someone that will offer you money to do nose tricks for them.
That sounds like the voice of experience there, Dan.
Yes. I didn't you ever hear about that?
No, not the nose tricks.
I have a channel on YouTube where I used to just do stupid stuff at work and record it. And
who, you?
Time,
come on.
Yeah, go figure, huh? And the one video was me just sticking my tongue, because I could stick my tongue into my nose. Not very
far. I've seen that.
And, where's my channel? Hold on, I'll post a link to the...
IRCTilts.org?
No,
yeah, but
no,
it's a different...
LinuxLink.net.
It's not Freenode.
Right, so which one is it?
It's the LinuxLink.net, just IRC servers, LinuxLink.net. Then join Pound Tech Show. Alright, I'm on my channel now. Where are my damn videos? Anyway, okay, here we go, my videos. It's called Product Placement. And it's very blocky. As soon as you go in there, I will post it. But some guy saw it, and he offered me $100 to do 60 minutes of me picking my nose, because he has a nose fetish.
Oh, That is funny. You got a fan? Oh, God.
Yeah, I got a fan. This can't be the right
thing. I'm really not quite... It's not that I don't think that's humorous or anything. I'm just not quite sure how to respond.
Yeah. No, it's the picking my nose with my tongue. There it is. That's the video. Now that you're in there, I'll post the link.
Yes, you
I've
will.
I've seen it
and
once. I'm not going to watch it again.
I'm not going to watch it now. I'll watch it later. Okay, I'll watch it now.
Yeah.
Dan and his damn link bait. He'll get me every time.
Hey, you should have been here earlier.
Here, I'll repost that one. Hold on.
No.
You could just go there.
I'm muting, Dan, just so you know, I'm muting the video, yeah?
That's fine. There's no profanity in any of these videos or any of these. But the other ones...
God.
Dave, if you go to their website, you can build one. You get to choose the color... And then you get to choose the orifice, the texture. Wow. You should check it out, man. Hey, let me go back.
Okay, that...
That is wrong.
Oh, what's most horrible is the fact that once your video ends, there's links to, like, 8 other tongue-licking videos.
Yeah, go figure.
Jeez. Hey, don't click on the Amazon link, Cafe Ninja.
That's not the Amazon. I posted to their actual website where you can build a custom one. Dave,
well,
we should go
there. With your referral? I mean, are you getting, you know...
No. No.
Oh, God, the fleshlight? Oh, man. Which, although I understand there is a minute, Heather Van Deven butt cast. Have you seen this?
No.
Imagine a fleshlight, but it's really like it's a bust of the nether regions of Heather Van Deven. What is it?
Who's
Van
she? She must be a porn star, right?
Oh, okay. How many does do I get to smack you with for that?
You know what? You know what, David? What the hell are we doing? This is a bad idea because the very reason why we're recording on a Saturday night is because this Google person wants to get the word out. And who does the Google person want to target? 13 to 18 year olds. This is not. Oh.
All I did was ask you to guess what I thought.
Whoa. Is that me?
No, that's not you. I think I know who that is.
Oh. So that's what y'all hear.
I had to kick it. That was Peter 64.
No way.
Yeah.
He was trying to call in.
Yeah. Oh. All right. We should probably get on to a topic while we're waiting for him to come in.
Is there a place for me to find said topics?
No. This is all off the cuff.
Okay. Excellent.
Honest to goodness.
Just so you'll know, Dan.
What?
I may have to drop out some because we've got... my 8-year-old's got another 8-year-old little girlfriend spending the night with her tonight. They'll be here shortly. That's why I'm making cookies. But I'll be back home.
Oh, that's you're making cookies, huh?
Making cookies.
Making cookies.
Is that what you said you bought today?
I bought Scott Pilgrim versus the World today.
Oh, yeah, that's it. But you haven't watched it yet, right?
No, I'm going to watch it tonight.
With the kids?
No.
How old's your daughter?
My oldest is 13.
She's going to love it.
I'll watch it first, but yeah, I got the, I guess it's the Blu-ray /DVD /useless digital download package. Anyway, you were talking about a topic?
Well, no, you know, I was just thinking today I might be out. Hold on, I'm going to tell him to come in through Skype. Hold on.
If it makes it funny, I'm actually calling you out of the hacked SIP box.
Really? Oh, the hacked SIP box. Yeah, okay. I thought you said Pat SIP box for a second. I was thinking,
no,
wait,
hacked.
Wait a minute. I said,
no,
that doesn't make any sense because Pat doesn't have a SIP box anymore.
The working one.
Would this be the first show that has people on from three different continents at one time, Dan, or not?
It could be.
Probably not.
There was a Colonel Panic episode.
Yeah, there was that.
But this may be the first Tilts. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think it might be. I don't know what our Skype
Peter 64 figures it out.
I'm trying to get him in through Skype. So I don't
Freedom
know.
Freedom Hater. Skype
Who, me? I don't even remember what our Skype account is. All right.
Mr. Special Fried Brown Rice. Oh, my God.
That's disgusting.
I hate you and your damn... You're friggin' link bait, man. And when I try to explain that to anybody, they doubt me.
What?
The Special Fried Brown Rice or whatever it was.
They don't
called.
Understand it?
No. Well, I try to tell them it's something they don't want to see, and it's but it's not.
They don't believe you?
Blah, 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 blah. And they're like, no, really, I don't want to... You're full of junk. It's not somebody's, you know, schnitzel. And I'm like, no, it is. And it's gross, and you don't want to see it. No, come on. I'm like, okay. Go. Go. And they go, and the reaction is always the same. They hit enter, and then there's that squinchy face like they just bit into a lemon. And then the complete head toss, push chair away from desk, oh, kind of reaction. Yeah. All thanks to you, Dan. I share your magic.
What? Wasn't there a guy at Self this year, Dan, that had that on his phone and didn't know what it was? He'd been carrying it around on his phone with the resolution.
Yeah, he did. I remember
every
that.
Guy from Florida, I forget his name, but he'd been carrying around his phone for over a year, I think he said. Didn't know
that's
exactly
right.
What it was.
He's like, okay. Oh, I have it on my phone. I was like,
oh, I know what his name was, and I never met him. Retard.
Good night, fellas. Is this
working? Oh, yeah, it's working really good.
Oh, good. Bloody asterisks. Stuff asterisks. Not worth the trouble.
No? You don't like asterisks anymore?
So, I was connecting, but what, with a lot of noise?
No,
yeah, we heard
dude,
that.
Nothing but noise.
I wonder what was going on. Anyway, I'll have a look at that later. One thing about Skype, it always sounds okay, doesn't it?
You got to turn the phone around, don't you?
Peter, I tried to tell him that your audio stream was just coming in reverse, so it sounded off.
Yeah. Yeah, that probably was the problem. Sorry, who's this? I know Dave and Dan, but I can't quite make out this voice.
Cafe Ninja.
Ah, there you go, because we only ever talk on bloody talk
you
show.
Hardly ever. Screaming 8-year-old coming in.
Yeah. Aren't you doing a guest today, Dan? Some interview or something? Or?
Yeah, but that's not for a while yet.
Oh, okay. I'm going to try to join the chat.
Oh, yeah. You're not on the chat, too? Yeah, you are.
Not on the desktop. No, on the laptop I am.
Honest to goodness.
You know this is all new to me, this stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah, IRC should be kicking your butt, right, Peter?
But, hold on, I need the, what do you call it? The tilt server. I must have it here somewhere.
Well,
brainwashed.
Well, now that you're on, I'll go into it. I was, who was I listening to? I did listen to you, Dave Yates. And I listened to a couple other shows. Oh, Linux Basement was the one I was listening to. The last one that got me thinking about it. The whole Ubuntu, Unity, Wayland, all that stuff, and I was thinking about it, and, like, I know Cafe Ninja, I know you are a pretty big Ubuntu user, which is good that we have you on, because you really like Ubuntu, and I'm not saying I don't like Ubuntu. I mean, I do like Ubuntu. And what I was thinking, you know, a lot of people were, like, complaining and up in arms and concerned about them moving away from GNOME on, you know, Xorg to Unity on Wayland. And that just, you know, that, to me, my initial reaction on that was, well, you know, that's what it's all about, choice in the Linux community. You don't like it, you don't have to continue to run Ubuntu, or you can still run a derivative that would probably have an Xorg with GNOME, or you can install GNOME, or you can go to Fedora or any other of the options. Which is beautiful. But then another thought process that I was thinking about kind of turned that around a little bit. And when Ubuntu came out about, what, 6-7 years ago, it positioned itself and really made a big push in the desktop environment, particularly geared to newbies, for lack of a better word. And it has really, I think, achieved that and does a fantastic job of maintaining that, and since then, there's been a lot of people, it's become the number one distribution, if I'm not mistaken, for the desktop. On top of that, it's garnered a tremendous user following of new people, and a lot of people who, when they hear Linux, what they actually hear is Ubuntu, and they refer to Linux as Ubuntu, and people, you know, it has a huge presence. It is number one. And my concern about that is, here we now have Ubuntu as an almost like 800-pound gorilla in the Linux community transitioning to Unity on Wayland. And while we can say all these other distributions can maintain the status quo, so to speak, but would they easily be able to retain the status quo with Ubuntu driving the majority of users into a specific direction? Whereas where we say in the past, you know, we look at it and say it's the FOSS community is a democratic community in some respects, a meritocracy, in that, you know, Fedora generally goes in the direction of the Fedora community, whereas we see Ubuntu going in the direction of Ubuntu, as opposed to this community surrounding Ubuntu. And granted, I think the target audiences between those two distributions are different, yet if we have Ubuntu dragging all these people who associate Ubuntu as being Linux into a specific direction, is that level of support and power, the people power that they have, their audience, going to force other distributions into that direction? And if they don't, cause confusion and schism in the Linux community when said people start to look around and say, well, here's Ubuntu that has a mass user following over here, and now we have a whole slew of other Linux offerings completely different.
That was well put, Dan.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think you summed up
that's, that's beautiful for a blog post, but that's a big can of worms.
It is a big... And, you know, because one of the things, now that I think about it, going back, I said to myself, last week I bought a song off of Amazon. An album off of Amazon. And stupid me, I did it at home, because usually I do it at work, and I have Ubuntu. I did it at home, and I'm using Arch at home. And I was like, crap, I need to get the Amazon downloader. Now, the Amazon downloader had a package for Ubuntu, Debian, Fedora, and I think it was
everything
SUSE.
But Arch.
Yeah, you don't have, but there was in the AUR repository, so I went to get it from the AUR repository, but that was a little out of date. It wouldn't build because it was trying to pull down packages that were in Debian, but not necessarily, I guess not in Arch, and it didn't work, long story short, and I didn't spend enough time getting it to work. I probably could have fixed it on my own, but I just went over to my MythBox, which has MythBuntu running on it, and I did it from there. But it said to me, you know, what happens now? And I look back, and what happens going forward if Ubuntu is on Wayland with Unity and nobody else is, and we got all these companies that if you want to, if they are more proprietary, like the Downloader, I believe, is proprietary, what's going to happen then when they are putting out these packages for Ubuntu, but what about the rest of the distributions? You know, we still have that issue of a schism.
Wouldn't you find, though, Dan, that if Wayland is or does what it's supposed to be, and is better, then it's just a natural flow that the other distributions would follow onto it anyway? And if Wayland for somehow fails and doesn't live up to what it's supposed to do, then it'll go by the wayside. Ubuntu will move to whatever's better, and everyone will follow that. Or one of the other distros, like Fedora, may come up with something better. Isn't that the way it works, though? Like, it's not
actually
like
to add on to what Peter's saying is, I feel like more than the free market powers, yeah, the open source community looks much more like Darwinism. The strongest will survive, and the rest will eat its young.
Right.
That's the way.
Dave, sorry, you saying something.
Sorry, Dave. Yeah.
I was agreeing with Cafe Ninja. That's how it's worked traditionally. It's a meritocracy, like you were saying, Dan. I think Wayland's inevitable. Probably, it's. I think more than one distro is going to go that way. I think Unity's just a dumb idea. There may be a divide or a fork in direction, so to speak. All it does for me is just validate my decision earlier this year to leave Ubuntu. They were going in a direction I didn't like, and I think for a lot of Linux users, like we are probably, that, you know, been using Linux a while, we won't go that direction with them. But a lot of new ones probably will. But I think there'll still be a larger ecosystem for them to explore, and they'll find other distros. I mean, I think Ubuntu is going to be a lot of people's foot in the door to the world of Linux, and, you know, a lot of people are going to love it. But a lot of people that's already in the door don't like the direction they're going.
Yeah, and I think this has been mentioned numerous times on heaps of podcasts, and you said it too, Dan. The beauty of Linux is, if you don't like that particular thing, you can just move off and go off on and find something you do like. I think I don't like Unity, you know, it does nothing for me. However, I can understand to a degree what they're trying to do. The interface of the Mac seems to have been very popular lately, and you can understand if they want to try to adopt that or mimic it or you know, I don't know exactly what a Mac looks like. I just understand that Wayland is to a degree, not Wayland, Unity is to a degree like the Mac. Well, you can't blame them if they're trying to target an audience that, you know, they can get to move over from the Mac. You know, do you think that's wrong?
No, I don't. I think you all make wonderful points, and I don't think it's wrong. I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is more to the point. I'm not so much worried about Wayland as I am, you know, Unity. Because Unity, see, what it comes down to is Unity is an Ubuntu project. And I'm wondering, with Ubuntu going in the direction that they've been going and toying with other things, like the whole thing about them possibly going open core or whatever, because they have such a profound influence on the mind share of Linux users, not necessarily developers, but the users, do we trust Ubuntu to lead in the direction that inevitably may require all the other people to kind of follow in some sense, be Not it doesn't have to, but is that going to weigh decisions towards what may or may not be the best option for the rest of the Linux community?
Can I answer that with a smart aleck remark?
You can.
Do you trust Canonical more or less than Microsoft? Because, I mean, I understand what you're talking about, this vast majority of Linux users, which seems like a huge percentage, but when you look at the overall computer market, you're asking us if what Canonical does on its worst day is nearly as bad as what Microsoft does every day with 95% of all computer users? Because if they change their GUI, everyone changes their GUI. So really, I mean, I think we need to take our necessary evils and prioritize them. And while there might be some uncomfortable situations with it, I'm not unhappy with the fact that there is an Ubuntu of the world that managed to actually gain not just a 200-pound gorilla, but be that 800-pound gorilla that can actually move some stuff around. Because as you leave it to open democracy, things get painfully slow, drawn out. And how long did it take us to get off of X11 and the old X to the new X? And how many years has a revision of the graphical stack been needed?
Sorry, Peter, go ahead.
I'm just going to ask a quick question. Would it be fair to say that if it wasn't for Ubuntu, what percentage of Linux users wouldn't there be at the moment? Like, I just think, and this is just straight off the top of my head, like I haven't read anything, I would say at least half the people who use Linux only use it because Canonical come on the scene. But I'd be interested to hear what you blacks think of that.
Oh, half might be a little high, but it's probably not terribly far off the mark.
I think Ubuntu is a gateway for a lot of people into Linux.
And I think it will remain a gateway, truth. I think you'll always have people who come into the gateway, then they start peeking under the hood of Ubuntu and going, wow, there's a whole bunch of new technical stuff down there. Slackware? What the heck is this? Oh my God, my head's exploding. And
yeah, that's
everybody
right.
Will settle down. Yeah.
And you'll get a certain percentage of people who just want to use the computer, who get sick of the viruses and the blue screens of death, whatever Windows has, and they're quite happy to run Ubuntu and not go any further. And they don't care. They don't even know what words like Wayland and Unity and all that sort of nonsense is. And they don't give a stuff about it. And then you were asking, do we trust Canonical to grab the ball and run with it? Well, the only thing I see is no one else ever picked that ball up and really ran with it to begin with. Like, I know there was Mandriva and that, but they seem to fail at quite a few hurdles. Novell sort of looked at one stage like they might get somewhere, but I don't know if it was really the deal with the devil or what happened with them, but they seemed to lose a lot of steam too. So who else was there?
Linspire.
I remember.
Linda. Hey, Pat.
But honestly, what's up, guys?
Yeah. Hey, Pat.
G'day, Pat.
How are you?
Well, I guess, you know, on the flip side to that, in a similar vein, there has always been the argument of choice versus too much choice. And one side says, oh, there's not, you know, choice is a good thing. The other side says, there's too much choice, somebody should make a decision. And here comes Canonical, and they make a decision. And then people get all worried because they make a decision. Case in point, I'm concerned in some respects that, you know, the decisions they're making, are they good for the community? But yet they are making decisions, unlike a lot of the other, quote, distributions, where they say, you know, we're not going to make a decision necessarily in the direction that we're going, but we're going to try and let the user have the opportunity to make that decision for them, but we'll support whatever choice that they make as best as we can by having the options in the distro. But Ubuntu says, here, this is what we're giving you. If you want to make it different, go ahead, but this is what we give you. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I think they're filling a void. A void that they created themselves, that and they're needed. Because honestly, if you subtract Canonical and Ubuntu from the entire equation, all you have is a crapload less Linux users. Stop. That's the only thing you have.
Yeah, I mean, Ubuntu's brought a lot of people to the Linux table, and that's the fact. People can bitch about them. They don't like what they do, whatnot. If they introduce closed and proprietary software or different software packages and different services that they might offer, you know, it's all water under the bridge at the end of the day. You know, the end is there's more people than there was before. Before Ubuntu, there was Debian, Slackware, SUSE. You know, we had our little community, and now there's a lot more people with it. You know, like you guys are saying, it's a gateway drug. If they come in, they check it out, they like what they see, they get used to the environment, they don't like what they want to do, they can go and check out Slackware. They can go check out Debian or whatever. It's there, it's for the taking. They can go and tweak and learn and go crazy. And that's a good thing to me.
Yeah, if it needs a bit of eye candy to do it, well, so be it. But people tire of it, move on. And
exactly.
All those
options.
That's the end
of the world, you know? They're a business, yeah, and they're looking to make money. They have their own agenda.
And they've been pretty clear about that agenda the whole time. I mean, from the get-go, really. Linux for human beings, they steadily moved in that direction. And they've not hidden the fact, I don't think.
Yeah, and Shuttleworth himself said that Canonical had to be financial, within 5 years. So it was pretty obvious when he said that he meant that Canonical is going to have to start making money. And that left no doubt as to how, you know, that they were going to have to raise money somehow, and if they can't do it through offering services like however Red Hat does it, they're going to explore other options, and of course you're going to do that.
Well, it'll be all right. It remains to be seen how Unity takes off. I mean, on one hand, I agree with you guys about the Wayland thing. I think it's a long time for a change, and with the technology it's going to bring to the table is great. Although it seems like they're really rushing it out the door pretty fast, including in the next distribution.
What's your concern with? See, to me, Unity's only a theme. It's nothing more than a theme.
Is it a theme? I thought it was a whole desktop environment.
Well,
it's a shell. For GNOME shell.
Oh, it still runs on top of GNOME?
The GNOME shell replacement.
But the fact of the matter is
it's easy to change, is it not? After a month and you don't like it, you can always replace it with something that you want. So
that's a question, though. I mean, is Wayland? I mean, can you take Wayland and run Fluxbox on top of it?
Well, at the moment, you can't run anything on top of it. Not Wayland, but now we're talking about Wayland or not. I thought we were talking about
That's what I'm saying. So Unity's going to run on top of Wayland. But is Unity running on top? Is it a replacement for Metacity for GNOME? Like I've heard somebody say, or is it its own desktop environment?
I thought the other one still could run on top of X.
I'm saying is irrelevant. I'm saying that if they're in the back ports will be GNOME, and when you install GNOME, you'll have to have X.
If you're upgrading your machine that's currently running X with GNOME or whatever, you'll just upgrade to newer versions of those packages. It won't completely switch you over automatically. This is more for the new install, right?
I'm not sure that these two can't live side by side.
I mean, maybe they can.
As far as I know, Unity just runs on top of X at the moment. And Wayland's got
it's still going to have to run on top of... still going to have to run on top of X, because the way I understand it, Wayland is a replacement for X, And Unity is a replacement for GNOME Shell. So Unity will run on top of GNOME one way or the other. So in order to get Wayland to, or Unity to run on Wayland, they're going to have to make sure that GNOME can run on top of Wayland.
Isn't Fedora planning on working Wayland in, like, in 15?
Into 15. They got to put in the testing. It'll be in the repo so you can try it, but it's not actually going to be in it yet.
Why can't I get a clear answer on the websites as to whether or not Unity runs on top of GNOME, or is it its own thing?
The only thing I've heard is that it's a replacement for GNOME Shell, but I don't know where I heard that or read it or anything.
No, well, that's what I thought today. That's all it is.
All right, let me look at this. Unity and Ayatana architecture. I'm looking at a PDF. All right. So, it feels like software stack with the applications running on top of Compiz, which has Unity Shell, and Unity Places, which runs on top of Ayatana, which is the Unity Foundations, which runs on top of the GNOME platform, which runs on top of X11, on top of the Linux kernel. So I guess it is more of a replacement for Metacity than it is a replacement for the entire desktop environment. Okay. My question is answered. Yeah.
The GNOME Shell is going to replace Metacity in a plain vanilla GNOME, but if you install 11.04 Ubuntu, GNOME Shell can be replaced with Unity.
All right.
In the Wikipedia page, it says that for Wayland, it says it is anticipated that X11 applications will be supported by an X server running as an application on Wayland.
So that's what I was thinking they'd probably do
one
anyhow.
It feels like Mac OS 10 has, right?
Yeah, so backwards compatibility, like, they'd have to do that, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah, because there's no way that the entire software library would all just be updated to work on Wayland tomorrow.
Yeah, port it over or whatever they do. Yeah.
I just hope it works better than X did on Aqua, because that was a terrible thing.
That was gross.
I just to clarify this for me, because I don't know what a Mac looks like. Does Unity look like the interface on Apple?
No. Well,
GNOME is terrible. If you took GNOME and put AVN dock at the bottom, that's very close to a Mac interface.
Yeah, it's just that a lot of the criticism I hear is that Canonical are trying to make Ubuntu look Mac-like. And I can
understand some things about the user interface for the Mac that was designed as user interface improvements, which are superior to anything else out there. So they're worth mimicking.
I don't know about that.
Not all.
I picked up an iPad on Friday, and to be honest, I wasn't blown away by the interface, and I did not think it was that intuitive. Now, this is coming from somebody who's worked on computers for the last 30 years, and I'm sure, if I play with it long enough, I could get used to it and learn the ins and out of it. But honestly, I don't see how that interface is any better than a Linux desktop or a Windows desktop. At the end of the day, anybody's got to go in and learn how to use it.
But you're looking at two different things there, too, Pat. You're not looking at an OS X desktop. You're looking at iOS 4 or whatever it is they want to call it on the iPad. And on the iPhone, that's not really a desktop per se.
Sure, it's not a full desktop.
It's more,
but it's an interface.
It's more like
an Apple interface
kind of thing. Well, sure, but it's not the same interface.
And people write about it like it's fucking greater than sliced bread.
Well,
No, I agree, but in fairness, not trying to intermix iOS 4 with, you know, OS 10, but the stuff that Canonical gets criticized for is making Ubuntu look like OS 10. Things like growl,
yeah,
things like
what I
system
do.
Notifications, yeah. Things like fonts and icons and integrated messaging bubbles and things like this. That's what they get all the static for.
I don't know. It's an interface, you know, and putting a 7-year-old kid in front of any desktop system or even a phone system, but, you know, an embedded system, you got to learn how it works, and they're all different, and they all have their quirks about it. And I don't see the learning curve being that much shorter on a Mac or a Windows box or a Linux box running GNOME or KDE or even Fluxbox, to be honest. Sure, there's little things that, you know, that are improvements here and there, but honestly, I don't see that much of a difference. That's just my opinion.
Well, we shall see. Oh, well. What are you screaming about there, Pat, that Android's a failure?
Yeah, there's this article that one of the ZDNet writers wrote, and he was saying that Android is a failure because third-party people could take Android and customize it to add and remove, you know, important pieces of it to their own needs. So, you know, as an example, he took Baidu, which is a vendor in China, taking Android and basically customizing the crap out of it, to the point where it doesn't look like Android that much. Now, I think this guy's really missing the point. You know, the whole point is it's open source software. You can do anything you want with it. It's you know, a set of libraries and a whole platform. You take them, you can add pieces, you can customize pieces, you can add your own software in it. You know, at the end of the day, it's still Android, but you can do anything you want with it. That's the whole point of open source software. It's about choice. Being able to do what you want to do, customize it, change it, that's the whole point of it. It's open, it's there for anybody to use. I think the guy is completely out of his mind. This is Dana Blackhorn, who's one of the main ZDNet writers.
It's the same excuse that Netflix is giving for not giving me my Netflix on my Android too.
What's that? They say that each phone is so different that there's no DRM scheme in place that'll work.
That's exactly it,
device.
Right there.
I think it boils down to this. I think it boils down to the CEO of Netflix is one of the main Microsoft guys, and he sits on the board.
No, it's not that. It's they're getting a lot of pushback from the movie industry people, saying that they can't properly secure, or they can't meet the security guidelines to be able to share DRM content on the Android phone.
Now, Netflix is on
Google
TV, which is running Android.
It wouldn't hurt Android whatsoever to get Netflix on there. It would be a good thing for them, so they have no reason to.
It's on Google TV right now.
Not want that.
I talked to Pat Archibald, you know, and he has the Google TV box, and it's got Netflix on there.
Sure, but that's more of a closed technology than your average Android phone.
But did you say Android was coming? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I don't know enough about the whole DRM thing, what they require, what they want, and what's on Android, to be honest, to answer the question. I can't make an intelligent opinion based upon what I know right now.
Did I hear that Android 3 is supposed to be a little more standardized as far as the interface goes? There is some, you know, with all the Android versions that are out there now, there's a lot of differences in the, I guess, the versions or the Android device you pick up as far as capabilities or interface, or I don't know exactly what it is.
What it is right now the main version of Android is 2.2. That's the most current version for you. And honestly, if you look at, like, the market share of what different versions, you know, the different pieces, I think it's already like 35-40% are on the 2.2. So right now, Froyo, the latest, is the main one that's out there. That's what's being released on all the newer phones. Now, they're supposed to roll out 2.3 Gingerbread pretty soon. And honestly, it's not that much difference as far as the what's on the OS. They're just making it better. They're cleaning things up. They're adding more capabilities. You know.
Hello.
Hey, Alan. When you write an Android app, you say what you want is the minimum, the full platform version. You can go in and say 1.5, 1.6, 2.0, 2.1, whatever you want. So when you write that application for whatever version you're writing it for, it should run on any version after the fact. Okay, so you're basically targeting, you know, whatever platform you want to do. And honestly, I think the oldest version of Android that's out there that's still kind of sizable piece is about maybe 1.6. So, you know, they talk about fragmentation. I don't think it's that fragmented, to be honest. I mean, what you're seeing is different vendors taking Android and customizing and putting their own stuff in there, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worst. I mean, you know, you start to get bloatware and crapware on there. I give you an example. This past Friday, I went out and I checked out some Android tablets that were out there. And I finally got a chance to check out the Dell Streak, and that thing is a piece of junk. I don't know what the hell they did with it. They customized the hell out of it, and they changed it so much that it doesn't resemble an Android device. It's really customized. It looks really different. They got their own buttons and whatnot, and I think they did a terrible job with it, and that's the Dell Streak. So I recommend people don't bother with that device. I also checked out a $300 tablet from Huawei. This is at Best Buy. I saw it at. And they called it the EDEO 7-inch tablet. It's also 7-inch. I played around with it a little bit. That resembles Android more recent. If I had to take a stab, I would say it's maybe running 2.0, I think it's on there. And I don't know. For $300, I don't think it's all that great. The display wasn't that hot. I thought it was a little clunky. And then there was another one that was selling for $300 called the Velocity Micro. And I thought that one was a piece of junk. I really did not like it at all, to be honest. And the one that blew it out of the water completely was the new Samsung Galaxy Tab. They were selling a version on Verizon and a version on Sprint. And I also got to see the version on T-Mobile. So I got to play with three different Samsung Galaxy Tabs on all three carriers. And on all three, I thought it was a very good device. It's got a beautiful display. It's very standardized Android. You go on there, you know Android. You have an Android phone. You will not get lost. You'll know exactly what does what. It's simple, straightforward. They do have some customized applications on there, like some of the video and multimedia stuff, but it's not that far from what's on any Android device. The only complaint that I've seen on there is they say that the battery life isn't as long as the iPad. I don't have one, and I haven't used it for so many hours, so I can't make an informed opinion about that. But other than that, the applications were fast. The device was super snappy. Things moved really nice. I thought it was really good. The web browser was really nice. I played the price is expensive. They're offering what you could do is if you go to Best Buy and you get a with no plan or nothing, it's $600, and that is a high price. I think they need to at least drop by $100. Okay, now if you go to T-Mobile and also if you go to the Verizon store or a Sprint store, they'll sell a subsidized price. I believe T-Mobile was selling it for $299, but you had to do a contract, a data plan. Let me just pull up T-Mobile and I'll confirm the price. I think that's the price, $299. And that's a little bit more reasonable, but you have to get a data plan because it's 3G, you're on a 3G network. They're not selling a version right now with just a Wi-Fi version. And I really think they need to do that. So until they drop the price, I think it's kind of high. But it's a really, really nice device.
7-inch,
really,
right?
I really liked it. It's a beautiful device, man. The display on it looks really nice. It's snappy. The games were awesome. I played some. There's like a racing game on there. I played a first-person shooter, 3D accelerated graphics. It looked great. It was a really, really nice display. I think it's a really nice experience. All these junky Android tablets that are out and whatnot are really giving Android tablets a bad name. I think the Samsung Galaxy is the one right now It's a really nice device. I'm also looking forward to seeing the Arcos devices. Arcos is coming out with a whole line of Android-based tablets in all different sizes. I think the first couple of ones are out. There's like a 2.3, There's also a 3.4-inch one. They're going to be coming out with a 7-inch one that's called the 70, and they're also going to come out with a 10-inch one. And
that's the one I'm waiting for right there, the Arcos 101.
The
10-inch.
Now, in Best Buy, they had the old Arcos
tablets. By the way.
That's a good price. That sounds really good. I really want to try that, and I really want to check that out.
That thing hits Best Buy. I'm going to be all over that like white on rice, man.
Right. Right.
Can't wait to.
What's nice about the Galaxy
that one
Tab?
Shows up in Best Buy too, so I can take a look at it.
Yeah, yeah. The Galaxy Tab has the full marketplace on it. So you can install anything you want. Now, some of these other tablets, they gimp it by not being able to install any applications on it from the marketplace. That is idiotic. I mean, granted, they're not customized and tweaked enough for a tablet, but the device themselves, you know, you should be able to run anything. I mean, I went and I installed a couple applications on there. They played fine. They scaled nicely. I didn't see any problems with it.
The problem, I think, there, Pat, is to do with Android unique identifier number or something, and a lot of the Taiwanese ones have the same number, from what I understand. And you can actually go in, if you root your device, and you can go in and hook it up to, what is it, the Android SDK or something, and you can generate a unique number, and then you can use the actual marketplace. But it's a bit technical for the majority of people. They're certainly not going to bother doing it.
The price on T-Mobile, if you get the subsidized, is $3.99, which I think is too high. It should be $2.99. It really should drop at least $100 off the board, you know, across the board. It's a high price right now. So the unsubsidized price should be no more than $4.99. And the subsidized price should be $2.99, where it's $3.99. So the price is high. They need to drop the price, and I hope they do. If they drop the price, they'll move units with the Samsung Galaxy Tab. And that's why I'm actually really interested in the Arcos. The Arcos seem very reasonably priced. The 7-inch one, I think it's coming in two variants. It's coming with an 8-gig variant that's going to be $269, and I think there's going to be one that's got a 250-gig drive for $299, I think. Let me look up the price. Now, the old Arcos one, in Best Buy, they had the old Arcos 7-inch one. They call it the Arcos 7. That thing, you can't access the marketplace. It was a little disappointing.
Every time I see one of those in Best Buy, I can't even turn the damn thing on. It's always
really?
Like frozen. Yeah, it seems
you
to
should
be
go
frozen
check out the Galaxy Tab, man. You'll like it. It's a nice device.
Go check it out.
Yeah, and I also play with an iPad for a bit. You know, the iPad's a nice device and everything, but it's a flawed device. There's definitely some deficiencies with it. You know, you can't do any multitasking on it. You know, like I said, I don't think the interface is all that intuitive if you've never seen it before and not familiar with, you know, iOS-type devices. But it is a nice device as far as the construction of it. You know, they put it together well. And those people at Apple know how to market their stuff. I give them that much credit.
But would it be fair to say the biggest problem with the cheap ones is the resistive screen and not the capacitive?
Yeah, well, you get what you pay for, not for nothing. I mean...
Yeah, and it just makes it seem so much slower than they really are with that screen.
Well, they're also slow processors. I mean, a 400 megahertz processor is not a gigahertz processor. The Galaxy Tab, I think, is a gigahertz processor, which is comparable to the better Android phones. It's fast and it's snappy. It's nice. It's quick. I thought it was blazing fast, to be honest.
It just comes down to what you want to do with your device, though. Well, personally, the only thing I typically do, and I think, Dan, you're the same, is use it for a reading device. And I watch the occasional movie when I'm laying in bed. But
no, I agree with you, and I'm firmly convinced at this point, after playing around with an Arcos tablet, which isn't bad, that I would be better suited... Instead of a device that tries to do everything, with a device that does one thing and does it well, and get a Kindle for reading, or something similar, I don't know. It's just,
yeah.
It almost comes out to that point where anything decent is going to run twice the price of a Kindle, and if I want to just do reading, why am I spending that much, and if I'm going to pay twice the price, I'm like another $100 away from a netbook or something that'll do... things even better. I don't know.
Arcos has the Arcos 28, which is a 2-inch one. This is the low-end one. This is $99. Okay. They have some other ones, too. They have the 101, which is not out yet. The 70 is supposedly out today, and supposedly they sold them out pretty quickly. Okay. They also have, let me see, the 32, I think, is a 3.2-inch device. That one's $149. Okay. And then they also have a 4.3-inch device, the 43. That one, I think, is $199. Let me see. $249. 4.3-inch. Now, 4.3-inch is pretty big. That's as big as the Evo, you know, the Sprint Evo, which is a pretty big screen.
Droid X is that big, too, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, yeah, like 4.3-something.
It's a big screen. I think 7 is a nice size form factor, honestly. You know, I was playing with the iPad, great. And I can summon actually using that thing. I can imagine it, you know, it's starting to get heavy at some point. You know, if you're sitting there reading in bed or whatnot, or it's on your lap. I think the 7-inch is a nice size. It's a little smaller. The screen is still pretty nice and big, and I think that might hit the sweet spot, honestly. Yeah, so the 7-inch...
I probably have to concur with Dan, just because I've got my comfort zone, where I've managed to go for so long with a... you know, smartphone and a netbook with a 3G modem. So it's hard for me to feel like I need to put one of these tablets of any ranging size in the middle of that. So I think when it comes time for me to make my next choice, which is probably going to be sometime next year, I'm going to have to take a very serious look at the lineup and the prices.
But I do like what Arcos is attempting to do. You know, I like the tactic that they're offering all different sizes and configurations of this device, okay, all at different prices. I think that's a really good tactic to do. You know, again, you know, obviously, we got to check it out once it comes out. I want to see this thing in person. I want to try it out, and I want to see what it does. I want to compare it to the Samsung. I want to compare it to the iPad. I want to see what it is and what it's like. If it's a decent device, they could do well, and if that's the case, then they need to advertise it. And they need to make it as available as possible. And if they can do that, they'll sell a lot of them.
Link.
Yes, sir.
Still there. What's the screen size on the Kindle?
It's six, like a 6-inch screen size.
See, and how much is the Arcos at that relative screen size? What's the price point of that?
The Arcos 7?
Yeah.
That
is that at
be,
7?
How much did you say it was, Pat?
The 70 or the 7? The 7 is the old one that's in the stores now.
The new one coming out.
One. You want the new one, the 70.
Let me just compare the price. The one that's in the store now, the Arcos 7, is $199. I tried.
You don't want
the
7.
Like
the 7 is sucky.
Yeah, the 70 is coming in two configurations. It's coming with an 8 gig card for $274, and with a 250 gig drive, $350. So $274 and $350.
And you see, if you wait for the 101 to come out, which is a 10 inch, that's supposed to be like $300.
Yeah. Yeah. But I could see someone wanting to go with the smaller one with the bigger storage. But honestly, these devices have slots in there, so you can add extra storage in them. The Galaxy Tab had two slots. It had a microSD and a regular card slot in there. So you could throw quite a bit in there. I don't know what the slots on this thing's going to be. It says microSD slot. So it sounds like it's only one slot on the Arcos. But we'll see.
But then again, we're right back to that whole thing where I'm saying, you know, for less than half the price, I can get an e-reader, like a Kindle or a Nook or whatever.
Well, like if that's what you're looking for, Dan, if your main objective with the device is to use it as a reading device, after having the Kindle 3 for, you know, a little while, I would say that's definitely the way to go. You know,
I think that's what I'm
yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm looking at.
Like I want
again,
it.
That's
I
all
want
you want, man. Go for
101 in the worst way, but I don't want it as an ebook reader. I want to use it as a tablet.
Yeah.
For
which
if
one
not
is
that? E-book, oh, man, buy yourself an e-book reader, and you will enjoy the shit out of it. I love my Kindle. It's awesome.
My Nexus busted. One, I'm really into like the retro gaming. I have a bunch of emulators on there with a ton of ROMs. I play a ton of those games, man, and I think it's great on the Nexus One. I could see doing the same thing on the Arco 70 of a Samsung Galaxy Tab, and I think it would be a really great experience playing all those old-style games on there.
Now, let's make it clear that all those games you have the...
they're all legally
obtained.
You have
the boards for. Yes, you have the boards for. Yes. The
cartridge is just sitting in a box in my closet.
There you go. I don't know, you know, although on the flip side, I could look at that and say, yeah, you know, the nice thing about those tablets, though, is, like, they'd be great for reading comic books on.
Yeah.
They're nice readers. Very nice readers. I tried the, I put Aldico on the T-Mobile. I went into the T-Mobile store, and I know the guys in there, and they had just got the shipment. The guy opened it up for me, and he took it out, and we were checking it out, and I threw Aldico on there. And I downloaded a couple of books on there, and it looked great on the 7-inch screen. It was nice.
See, and then that's the thing, though. I mean, I could use those. The benefit that when I looked at it, you know, the other side of me says I can do the e-reader thing. Like the e-ink is appealing on the Kindle, but on the flip side, if you get one of these tablets, you're not restricted to any one of those. Readers, you could do the Kindle, you could do the Nook reader, you could do the crappy Borders one, which sucks ass, and you could do Aldico,
you know,
Moon reader.
It's not the same.
Whatever.
It's not the same, Dan. It's not the same. Well, you know, if
yeah,
you,
the software is not the same as looking at it on the hardware.
Yeah, but the look and the feel and stuff like that is not the same either. You can run, you know, get an e-book and stick it on your little netbook. And, you know, hold it sideways so you can see kind of what it's going to be like for you to read on that. And then if you use a Kindle or a Nook right next to it with e-ink, it's completely different. The e-ink is like reading a book. You know, there's no backlight. There's no...
It's easy on the eyes.
Text is
very,
very,
it's very
easy on the eyes. It's a completely different experience on e-ink than it is with some backlit LCD technology. And, you know, I mean, it's just, in my opinion, it's a lot better. If you're
Can
gonna,
I ask
you, know,
you guys,
really
with a Kindle, is the battery life they advertise of like a month, is that for real?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. I got mine, what did I get, my like 3 weeks ago now, guys? Maybe a month. I charged it once. The battery life is
phenomenal.
Fab
was saying his
thing
was going for like days.
Yeah. Mine is phenomenal. You know, literally I have charged it once and it's still going.
That sounds like a device.
The battery left.
That's all you're interested in, man? Get a Kindle.
Especially with the Wi-Fi and the new WebKit experimental browser in it, it can't be totally icky.
I haven't even tried the browser on mine. I mean, that's not what I got it for. I got the Wi-Fi version. I got the cheaper version. And I read books on it. And
I've done the Wi-Fi.
I love it, man. I dig it, you know.
I've done the browser on my Nook. It's not bad. I mean, you probably, you know, if you just need to look up something real quick, I wouldn't use it as a browser, you know, all the time. Because it is very, very slow. But, I mean, if you just need to look up something real quick, it works fine.
Yeah,
I'm considering the Kindle as well now that we can get them in Europe.
Link, did you say you turned the Wi-Fi off?
No, I leave mine on, man.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if you get it,
Wi-Fi's always on there, and I just, you know, I turn the Kindle on and off when I'm using it or not using it, and.
If you get the Kindle in Italy, in Europe, like if you decided to come back to the United States, could you still use it in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Or would you? So it'll work with the U.S. store then too?
Yeah, actually, when they launched the Kindle 3, finally also in tandem with Amazon.co.uk, they had in place roaming agreements. So if you have a Kindle 3 3G from the States and you go to Europe, it'll work.
Oh, awesome. Peter, question for you. You still there?
You fell asleep.
Yeah, sorry, now I was muted. Sorry. Yeah, I'd be disappointed if you
question.
Didn't.
If you order a book on the Kindle in Australia, do they send you the Dead Tree copy?
Yeah, Dan, you know you're being silly. You know if I order a book, I have to write it and send it to them. You always got to be silly.
Ah, okay. All right, my mistake, sir. My mistake. Whoa. I don't know, Link. I wish you'd shut up about your damn Kindle, because I'm getting sick of hearing it.
You know you want one.
I know I do.
What's wrong with the Kindle is you can only get the books from Amazon, right? You can't go to any other marketplace in the store, right?
You can import it. You
Why not?
No.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can import your own, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can do that with any of the e-readers. That getting your books from somewhere has absolutely nothing to do with what device you get, because you can format any book to go on any of the devices without very much hassle.
It's kind of like the iTunes thing being misleading. Really, you just have to have the MP3s, and you bring that into iTunes, and then you get it on your phone or your iPod or whatever.
Yeah, definitely.
It doesn't matter where it really came from.
Well, I thought that if I went and ordered an e-book from Barnes & Noble, they allow me to download it from the website, but it has some kind of DRM on there that I can't read it in anything but their
reader. To be fair, whatever else you get your hands on, they have to be open EPUB.
Right.
EPUB I would never recommend this because it's probably illegal, but there are a lot of pieces of software out there that will DDRM your books so that you can put them on whatever device you want.
Yeah, DVD Dan has a cousin who likes books. DVD John, sorry.
Yeah, you know what? I saw ways to crack, like, the Amazon DRM, but the only thing that I found at the time was it requires you to actually have a Kindle so you could use the serial. You need to get the serial number off the Kindle that the book was downloaded from, and the Android application did not have that serial number available to you that I could find, like you could on the actual Android device.
Now this is something, Link, maybe you can share. If you import a EPUB into your Kindle, that won't sync through your Kindle applications, will it?
What do you mean sync through it? Like,
well, I know they have the
different devices or something.
Exactly. I know the Kindle software and the Kindle itself sync with each other, so that if you read on an iPhone, it catches you up on your Kindle when you open the book there next time. But it won't do that if you've imported. It's only for the books you buy, right?
I would imagine so, yeah.
Yeah.
But you can't read EPUB books on a Kindle anyway. You have to convert them to Mobi.
Oh, there we go.
All these formats, man, they kill me.
But, you know, pretty much if you have a Kindle and you're reading a book on the Kindle, you would normally continue reading the book on the Kindle.
Yeah, the Amazon store is nice. The Kindle app is nice. I've bought a couple books on my Nexus, and, you know, it's nice. You know, you got the whole DRM thing, you know, that's a whole big debate, you know, whether or not, you know, it should be there. It sounds like the publishers are insisting on it. Unfortunate, you know.
Well, there are a great number of like websites and stuff where you can buy EPUB books too. There's a lot of stuff available out there, and there's a lot of the book vendors are selling books online, you know, ebook type formats that are not DRM encumbered, PDFs and things like that. You know, you when you get from O'Reilly or whoever, you can buy stuff in PDF form, and that's not DRM encumbered, and you can just drop them on your Kindle or whatever the hell you have, and read them just fine. You know, I mean, there are alternatives to buying, I guess, DRM encumbered books.
The Amazon's books are DRM encumbered, but their music isn't. Is that right?
Correct.
That's right.
Music
right
is
now,
pretty much
anyway,
open now.
You know, they may
actually no one's doing.
They may take a turn.
I mean, no store is doing non-encumbered. Well,
that wouldn't have happened right. Without Amazon getting into the market. You really think iTunes would have opened it up if it wasn't for Amazon?
No,
probably not.
No way.
The irony that Amazon jumps into digital books with nothing but DRM at first.
Yeah.
It's
pretty funny.
Oh, well. DRM, hooray. You know what? Speaking of the Kindle application and how it compares to, like, the Nook application, which I like the best of all, I found out on the Kindle application, when you fired it up on the Android, that there are features that aren't in the typical menu that you can set. Like when I bring up the book, if I pull the menu up and I get view options and stuff like that and more, there are certain features in there that aren't very well documented, that they don't exist in that menu that I can sit. Like, for instance, when I rotate the phone, I don't like it going from portrait to landscape mode when I'm reading a book. I want it to stay in portrait mode. That's not an option in the menu, but if you press the lower left-hand corner of the screen, or lower right-hand corner of the screen, there's a little lock feature on there that'll lock it, and I wouldn't have known that if I didn't accidentally bump it the other day, which I found quite annoying that it wasn't an option that I could set in the menu itself.
But, do you bump into features a lot, Dan?
Yeah, I bump into a lot of features, especially when I'm hanging out at the restaurant. No, we don't. But you know, whereas the Nook and Aldeco and all that, there's like an option in their menu, in their settings. They're like, do you want to lock the orientation? And you click that, and then you're done. It's not like a surprise when you bump into it, and it's not hidden. Anyway, I guess we better call this person up, shouldn't we?
Who is your guest, Dan?
Carol Smith.
What's he or she do? Carl or Carol?
What's that, Peter 64?
What was the person's name?
Carol?
Carol Smith.
Carol. What do they do?
She's program manager of the Google Summer of Code and the Google Code-In.
Okay.
Have we had her on before?
I can't remember if she came on with Leslie or not last time they talked about Google Summer Code. I think she did. I don't think she talked too much.
Yeah, she was pretty quiet. So this isn't Summer Code. This is another thing they're doing, right? They're doing some kind of competition for younger people to get involved in programming.
Yeah, it's sort of like Google Summer Code, except it's in the winter and it's for high school kids.
That's cool.
All right. I'm going to have to drop out and call her so I can transfer her in.
My being on a cell phone is not going to hamper anything, is it, Dan?
No, we only have two connections in, and you're only one on there.
Okay.
So, give me a minute. Talk amongst yourselves. I will bring her in. Right, Alan?
Right, that
works for me.
I'll be back in a minute.
Peter.
So what tech? Go ahead.
I was just going to ask Peter when he flushed the toilet, did it act like a bidet?
He's like, you've got them all. Hey, I tell you, that lady you had on a lot of Linux links was really, she was the happiest little veg you might have heard in years. Really cool.
That's a face like
that. Is that the Fedora Ninja?
Yeah, she was really cool, I thought.
Yeah.
That was a great interview.
Yeah, she was fun.
How do you people eat that stuff, man? I knew somebody who brought back a can of that stuff, Vegemite, from Australia, man.
Yeah.
That stuff tastes like complete ass, man, let me tell you.
It's funny. Az loves it. I sent Az a big jar. He absolutely loves it. Maybe I got the wrong brand. Well, I think there's only one, isn't there? Kraft Vegemite.
I don't know.
I think so.
But I think it's one of those things you either love it or you hate it.
I mean, it's absolutely disgusting.
What's in it, Peter?
It's got something to do with the yeast from beer that's left over from when they brewed beer or something. To be totally honest with you,
Dave. They have beer in
Australia. So is it a barley product or is it just extra yeast?
No, it's a yeast.
Okay.
It's the yeast extract from what's left over or something from when I did the beer.
Yeah, we put that stuff in vats and throw it away.
Well, I think that's what they used to do here. Until someone must have put a bit on his bloody toast one morning and thought, gee, that's all right. We might be able to sell this. Hey.
Now, you guys put that, like, on crackers and bread, right?
Yeah, typically. Yeah, toast. Yeah, some people put it on, like, say, biscuits and all that.
Yeah, I just don't have, like, butter or jelly down there.
No peanut butter?
Yeah, we have peanut butter and jam. We don't have jelly, but I think when you say jelly, you're talking about what we call jam, like strawberry and apricot and marmalade.
Yeah. They've got fruit in it, like that,
the Nutella stuff, right? That stuff is popular in Italy, Spain, Nutella.
Yeah, I've never
had
hazelnut.
That. Hazelnut. That's really sweet. Yeah. It's hazelnut based.
Hazelnut, apple butter or something weird.
Actually, the way they flavor it up over here, the Nutella stuff, it really does come out tasting more like chocolate.
Yeah, it's very chocolatey. I've had it over there, too, and it's very chocolatey tasting. But, yeah, they use that stuff like instead of peanut butter. They love that stuff. That definitely tastes better than Vegemite, in my experience.
I sent some over to, like, Clark 2 and Monster B 330, and they all hated the bloody stuff. Pegwell loved it, though.
It was horrendous, man.
Pegwell would.
But, like I said,
sounds like
that's because he was looking at it through his Australia glasses where everything's backwards.
Yeah, makes everything upside down, it's thick enough. So what stuff are you guys looking forward to getting for Christmas? Do you have anything on your wish list?
Not me.
Not really. I bought my wife a new Dell laptop.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, I wish I could, but I don't know if I'm gonna. I don't know how Christmas is gonna be this year. I got a couple of bills that have come up unexpectedly again.
You buying more furniture now?
No. Unfortunately, my mother-in-law is in the hospital, and I think I'm gonna have to pick up a lawyer to get rid of some stuff that's going on. And since she hasn't got the money, it probably means I'm going to have to front it for right now. That's pretty much going to be Christmas for me.
Bummer.
Hate to hear that.
Yeah, I still may try to get some. I really want to get a new camera. But I'm not totally sure if I'm going to be able to swing the grand it's going to cost me to get a camera.
Did you last say a lot, Alan?
Yeah. I'm looking at a Canon T2i.
I got the EOS. Mine's a bit old. EOS 10.
Okay.
Yeah, but still. I won't be replacing that one.
Yeah, the first one, the first EOS that came out from them. It works fine, but I just really want a new one. Every 10 years or so, I decide I just want a new camera.
Christmas in Australia is July 25th, isn't it, Peter?
Exactly. You're better at this than bloody Dan. No funnier, mind you, but still. Actually, how many sleeps?
You know what's sad is they don't actually ask you the real questions, like, dear Peter, when you flush the toilet, does it really spin backwards? Or, something else, dear Peter, in December, is it warm down there? They don't ask you those
sensible
questions.
That's right. Wouldn't get that out of
you guys. Really don't get much of a winter, right? It's pretty much warm all year, right?
That's not entirely true. We get probably here where I am at the moment, down around, we get a couple of days like -5 in the mornings, but typically the days are still pretty nice, even 14, 15 degrees. Up in Canberra, it's bloody cold.
It's not like you get snow down there, though.
Well, not where I am, but up in my house in Canberra during winter, I can see the snow on the Brindamella mountain ranges. Occasionally it does snow in Canberra. Probably, once every couple of years you'll get snow in Canberra. But obviously,
Hawaii has snow up on the mountains.
Come on.
When you're at 10,000 feet, man, you're going to get snow.
Yeah. Canberra's cold. It is. But probably not your type of cold. The snow doesn't settle on the ground for very long on the occasion it does snow.
But it doesn't settle on the ground very long in Pennsylvania either. I mean, it's only, 4 or 5 months?
Yeah.
And 4 or 5 stories.
Right.
No, we've had a couple of days.
The worst we got it last year was, we got 3.5 feet or something like that, so.
We got 3.5 inches.
But it wasn't that bad.
We had 2 days last week.
It's not like you live
week.
In Buffalo, you know? You live in Buffalo or Syracuse, man, you get buried up there.
Yeah, I used to live out that way. That's true.
You get all that lake effect stuff, man? That sucks.
Oh, yeah. Back when I lived in upstate New York, it wasn't 3.5 feet of snow in the winter. It was 3.5 feet of snow, a snowstorm.
Yeah, it's pretty bad up there.
So
after so many months, it gets pretty depressing.
You know, Atlanta, what are you living 3.5 inches, you have to wait 4 years. Cumulative.
Cafe Ninja, where do you live in Italy?
I live in Cagliari, which is on the island of Sardinia.
Oh, that's nice. Sardinia's supposed to be nice.
It's pretty. It's very pretty.
What time you got Cafe Ninja? It'd be 2 or 3 in the morning, is it? Or? Oh, no. Yeah, all right.
About the same time as it was last time we did this.
Yeah, that's what I was just looking at. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I'd give you my kooky Christmas gift that I want. I want to get a bagpipe MIDI controller so I can learn how to play the bagpipes without driving my family insane.
Are you
really?
Yeah, it's basically, it looks almost like a recorder, almost.
You have to do the bag thing with it, too?
No, there's no bag. It looks like a recorder. It's just a piece of PVC pipe, and it's got the finger holes, like, you know, like you play on the cantor, on the bagpipe. And there's about two or three different ones that are out on the market, and they vary in price. They're roughly about $300, $350 or so, depending on which one you get. And, you know, they send you samples, and you can, you know, pipe it through like a MIDI controller, like any other MIDI controller. And you can use the sample sounds, and it sounds just like a bagpipe.
That's cool.
Yeah.
They make one of those for a kazoo, I think, too. I think I've seen a kazoo MIDI controller? Yeah.
Really?
But what you can do, though, is once you play the tune, you'll have that, I guess, in MIDI format. So you can, you know, compose music and then change it inside of MIDI, I guess. But,
yeah, the whole point with all these different controllers is, you know, it resembles the device that you're comfortable playing with. You know,
yeah.
Most MIDI controllers are keyboards. You know, that's the default one. But there are also other ones too. I mean, they have like a sax one, they have a flute one, and now they have a bagpipe one. And you can also do it on a guitar too. They have these MIDI pickups that you can use your guitar as a MIDI controller. Basically, all it is a bunch of just setting on-off switches, basically.
Yeah.
And the magic happens in the synthesizer or the sampler. And
that's cool.
You know, a sampler, you know, going back in the 60s and 70s, they had these devices. They were called Mellotrons, and they were like these keyboards that had tape loops of different devices. Most commonly, they were like strings or pipe sounds. And a lot of the progressive rock bands from that era, like Yes and even Led Zeppelin, they used Mellotron quite a bit extensively, you know, the Moody Blues and whatnot. And the problem with those devices, when you would play them, you know, it would literally play a recording of whatever instrument on a tape loop, you know, and the tapes used to break sometimes when they were in the middle of playing them. So, you know, fast forward to like the 80s and the 90s when they got MIDI, now you have digital copies of different, instruments. And you're basically doing the same thing, but you don't have to worry about the same thing breaking on you when you're playing.
So, sorry, Pat, did you say you play it now, or you're going to start
playing
it?
Well, actually, I picked up a little cheapy MIDI controller. I picked up this little Akai keyboard. It looks like maybe a, you know, not even a 2-foot-long keyboard, you know, maybe 2 octaves. And, yeah, I got it working in Linux. I jumped on the open source musicians. I asked around. I talked to Claudio, recommending a MIDI controller that worked in Linux, and he recommended the Akai. It was pretty reasonably priced, and I've got it working. I plug it in, it's recognized. I install. You got to get Jack going, which is pretty straightforward these days. You get the Jack server, QJack controlled, so that you can start it up and stop it. And it also has like a virtual patch bay, so you can route the sound and the controller to whatever software you're using it with. So, you know, once you get Jack on there and QJack control, then you need either a synthesizer or a sampler. And the two that I've played with is Zin Ad Sub FX, which is a synthesizer. And that works really nice. There's lots of nice sounds in there. There's a lot of strings and pipes and some pianos. And that's pretty cool. There's a lot of sound banks in that. That's a very popular piece of software. It's basically, you plug in the MIDI controller, you fire up Jack via QJack control, and then you fire up the synthesizer or your Linux sampler software. And then what happens is with Jack, you open up, they have like I said, a virtual patch bay. You fire it up, and from there you can see your MIDI devices that are connected, and then you can also see the synthesizer or the sampler software. And what you need to do, you need to do two things. One, you need to bind the MIDI controller to the software that you're going to be controlling, okay? So on the left-hand column, you'll see like your MIDI controller. And on the right-hand side, you'll see the actual software that's running. So if you're running Zinad at Sub FX, you'll see it on the right-hand column. And then what you got to do is it's like a little drop-down. You click it, and then what you do is you drag a little line going from the MIDI controller to the software package, okay? And then there's a tab for output. And what you do is you route your output going out to the system output. So this is not unlike what happens in like a recording studio. You know, they would route signals, you know, with patch cables into these patch bays. Well, now it's all done virtually. So once you patch up those two things, now you can go into your synthesizer and pick your sound, and you could start playing that on the keyboard, and out comes your sound and all the different sounds that you could play with. And I also played with the Linux sampler, which is another one, and that's pretty cool, too. There's not quite as many sounds as on Zin Sub FX, But it's a sampler. So what it is there's other sampler software in the MIDI world. And what it is you basically take like a WAV file and you import it in and you turn it into what's called a GIG file, .gig. And this is like a standardized audio sample. There's all different synthesizer samplers that are able to do this and generate these GIG files. So long as you got that GIG file, you can import it into Linux Sampler, and then you can use that sound with your controller. So it's pretty cool. I mean, you know, it's a really nice grand piano that someone pulled in, and it sounds quite nice. You know, there's other stuff into the horns and some synths, but there's a lot of GIG files out there on the market. You have to go out and buy some, possibly. It's not like, you know, there's massive amounts of them freely traded. I don't know if there's trademark or copyright or whatnot.
Is Carol in here?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good.
Oh, there she
is.
I want
to make sure.
Hey, guys.
Hey,
Carol. Hello.
How's it going? Happy Saturday.
Happy early Turkey Day.
Don't you mean Sunday?
Thank you.
Yes, almost Sunday.
Yeah, Peter's in Australia, so it's Sunday.
Yeah.
And Cafe Ninja's in Italy.
Yeah, you're in Italy, so it's Sunday already, too.
Sunday as well.
My God, they're from the future.
And the rest of us on the East Coast in the U.S.
From the future.
not listening to Hacker Public Radio? Really? You need to listen to Hacker Public Radio for your daily dose of community-created content, technical tips, super elite hacker how-tos, gaming and gadget reviews, and much, much more.
Oh my God, it's Hacker
Public Radio! Catch it Monday through Friday at hackerpublicradio.com.
What I want from you, I want you to be the same. That is what you will do. You will spoon feed the news, the same technology news to everyone. You will not help people. You will not give them tips. You are not unique. You will conform. No, we won't. Join the revolution in Augcast. Listen to the GNU World Order. For more info, go to www.thebadapples.info.
Can we talk about the new search of computers?
Can we talk about multiprocessing?
Can we talk about Beowulf clusters?
Can we talk about Web 2.0?
Just talk geek to me.
Just talk geek to me.
Hey, it's Steve Geek. Please come check out my podcast for my take on all things geeky. You can find us at www.talkgeektome.us. That's www.talkgeektome.us. Thank you.
Just talk geek to me.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy, I have the gun!
It's over.
All right, so that's it for this show, I think, tonight. What do we have going on here? We got 2 hours and 30 minutes of recording. Woo! Man, oh man. You know how much editing that's going to be on my part?
You'll get
none.
That or
five. That's right, Peter 64, none. Now I might get rid of some of the silence.
Truncate silence, that's what I do, Dan, and then post it, and then listen to Clutch and whinge about it.
That's all I do. What else? Oh, Linux Link, or the Linux Link Tech Show Trivia Contest. Of course, the one person that needed to be informed of this has now left. But what we're going to do anyway? We've been talking about it for like 3 or 4 weeks now, what we're doing with this is procrastinating as long as we possibly can before we actually do this and give out the prizes. What it is, I believe, is a couple of magazines. Something like that. I don't know exactly how many we have. Link has all that information. See how well organized we are. But we're putting out 4 questions. One went on the forum. One already went in the mailing list. One's going on the website. And the other question that we have that we're putting out is going to go out on this show right now. And I hope that it's not going to be the same question that Link is going to post on the website, because he didn't tell me which one he's going to post. And that's the way he rolls. But here it is. The trivia question that in the show. How many times has Richard M. Stallman been on our show? How many times? Do not send just that answer into us. When you have the answer to all 4 questions, send them into... Did Link ever say an email of what to send it into? Dave, do you recall?
I don't remember.
Send it in to techshow@thelinuxlink.net, because I can't remember any other email. I think he might have said contest@tllts.org.
Yeah, contest ringing the bell.
Was that it? Yeah. Send it in to contest@tllts.org. Check on the forum where you saw the question, and it'll be updated with that email. So go ahead, when you get all four questions answered, send them in. And those people who have all the questions correct, we will draw out random winners from there. And Link's oh-so-random winner generator that he used last time. Gentlemen, you have any questions about that?
No, sir.
Nope.
Oh, Alan, I forgot that you were on.
Yeah, I'm still here.
What was that, Peter?
What's the answer to the first three questions?
Oh, the answer to the first three questions.
Actually,
I'll
know the first one. One was who was your first guest. That's the only one I've seen. That was in the mailing list. One's on your site, yes?
One is going to be on the site. One's on the forum, and one's... Don't announce all the questions on the show, Peter! You're killing us.
I thought you told people. I thought that's what people got to go looking for them.
Yeah, you got to look on our mailing list. You can look at the archives of the mailing list at thelinuxlink.net/mailman/listinfo/TLLTS. But
or just join it.
Question? Or you can join the mailing list. You're still going to have to look in the archives, but I said I would repost the question again. There's one in the mailing list, one on the forum, one on the website, and the one we just announced, which is how many times has Richard M. Stallman been on the show? This is open.
Use your inside voice, Peter.
Yeah.
Sorry. I didn't know it was such a secret as to where the questions were. It's like an Easter egg hunt, is it?
It's like a what contest?
Yeah. Easter
you know what?
Egg hunt.
This the Easter egg. This is open to everybody but people in Australia, Peter. Now you ruined it for them.
Because if I wasn't going to win, no one's allowed to.
That's right. You blew it for everybody now. You invalidated your entire country.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Both of them.
any gentlemen, any other things that you'd like to add for tonight? Anything you wanted to talk about before we cut up the show?
No, thanks for having me on, fellas, and I'll talk to you. I'm going to see what my daughter's doing. I'll talk to you later on.
Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate you coming on, taking out for your busy schedule. I love you, man. Have a good one.
Good talking to you, Peter.
Okay. Yeah, Dave. Have a ninja. I'll catch you in the IC, no doubt. Okay, ta-da.
Damn, Cafe Ninja, you've been up really late tonight.
Yes, I have been.
I appreciate you coming on, too. Now, stay tuned in the future, because we are actually going to have Cafe Ninja on as a guest to get more on the man, the myth, the legend.
In fact.
But before we go, please, pimp your show, because it's really good. I enjoy it very much.
Oh, thank you. I write at cafeninja.blogspot.com, and my podcast is The Tinfoil Hat Show, available at fusionpodcastnetwork.com, Fusion with a Z.
That's it. Same fancy place the hack guys are from. What's that, Dave?
I said fancy. The Z.
Yeah. Now, Dave, you have a show that a few people have heard of, yes?
I don't know. Yeah, I do a show. There's nothing to talk about. Nothing special.
That's it. There's way to promote yourself there. A lot of Hell Linux yeah. links. Linux user, Linux podcast, Linux.
Linux.
You know what? I bet you, like, all the people that listen to this show listen to your show, and they probably heard about our show from your show. That's how big you are. You are the man. Alan, you have a show too, right?
Yeah, the Linux Link Tech Show.
And you are the Linux promoter for the Tim McGraw Show, correct?
No. I have nothing to do with that stuff.
Excellent. And is there anybody else on that I missed? No, just Alan, Cafe Ninja, Dave Yates. Alan, anything you want to add?
No, I'm pretty good for right now.
You know, I have a question for you, Cafe Ninja.
Okay.
Are you going to be celebrating Thanksgiving?
I am.
Do they give you time off for that?
Negative.
Huh, I was just curious.
Funny well, thing, pilgrims didn't come to Italy.
They didn't? No, I didn't know if you actually got time off for that because you're...
Oh, I get time off if I take it. Of course, uh-huh. I do get 26 days of vacation a year.
Wow. So you mean the pilgrims didn't stop, drop off at Plymouth, and then
no.
go back to Italy?
No. I thought no. they stopped to pick up some bologna or something.
They made a big pot of spaghetti, right? Because that's all Italy is a big pot of spaghetti and pizza.
Big. Now, see, apparently, Dan, you have some amazing cultural insight.
That's it, huh?
Yeah.
You know what? I've been to Italy. I have been to Italy. It's an interesting country. I've only been to northern Italy.
Oh, you saw the best part then.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't think that was the best part of Italy.
Oh.
If Venice is not...
Oh, ye of little faith.
Oh, I don't know.
I could regale you with tales that would make your toes curl, sir.
Oh, I don't want to get too deep into this, because this is stuff we should be asking you on the next show.
But, yes.
All right, I'm going to stop the recording, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Have a happy Thanksgiving for those in the United States and for those outside
happy
the United
Thanksgiving.
States. Enjoy your Thursday this week. Well, and Black Friday. Alan, you're going to be out on Black Friday, aren't you?
Hell no. I used to have to work in a grocery store and a food store that had a grocery-type place in it. No, I will never go out on Black Friday again.
I thought grocery stores would be Black Wednesday.
Well, that was true for that kid. No, this is like a Walmart-type store. You know, had you know, food and clothing and stuff in it.
Never closing.
It was fun to watch people come in on Black Friday, but it wasn't fun to work it.
Huh. Yeah, well, do they do Black Friday in other countries, or is that strictly, again, U.S.?
Oddly enough, it's being pimped only as a marketing. It's like that Cyber Monday thing. You know, it's a fictional thing.
Huh.
If you go to Amazon.co.uk, for example, they have big Black Friday sale. It's like, really? A British guy is going to know what the heck a Black Friday sale is? Okay.
Cyber Monday's the Monday following, right?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. So everybody goes back to work and gets the sales online.
I'm off.
Work.
The sales
I'm off that day, so.
Me too. No, I lie. I'm off this Monday. Dagnabbit. Foiled again.
What's this Monday that you're off for? Or are you off the whole week?
No, I'm just taking off Monday because it looked like a Monday, so I thought I'd take it off. I have that kind of time to dispose of so I don't lose it at the end of the year.
Oh, yeah. Now, is your end of the year December 31st?
Yeah.
No, I asked because, like, my...
I know what you mean.
Yeah?
No, because I mean, like, my end of the year is October 3rd, so I have to use all my vacation by October 3rd every year.
You mean you're observing a fiscal year?
No, I'm observing my hire date.
Which, oddly enough, happens at the beginning of what is a fiscal year.
I guess so, yeah. Like other people have it, you know, it depends on when your hire date was. Mine was October 3rd, so yeah, fiscal year.
Okay. No, yes. No, ours is calendar, so it doesn't matter if you're hired on a November or a July or whatever. As far as holiday days and what you earn and what gets cut off at the year's end, that all is based on January through December.
Yeah. All right.
But
you
they
know,
do
now
something weird with our pay where we get 14 months of pay.
Oh, yeah? 14 months of pay?
So they take your base, right, and instead of dividing it by 12 and giving you one per month, they divide it by 14. And they give you one per month as you would expect, except in July and in December, mid-month, bam, you get an extra paycheck.
That's crazy.
It is. It's just wild, man. But it does make for a nice Christmas.
That is wild.
So you get paid
once
a month?
Do they have the number 12 in Italy? I mean, why do they do that? Do they just have to use 14? That's just weird.
Well, they originally did 13. Well, okay, wait a minute. They originally did 13 because there's a huge holiday push in summer. They actually have a season of 3 weeks in August that they call Ferragosto, which loosely translated means the August vacation, where almost the entire country shuts down. Everybody's on holiday. Everybody's at the beach. Originally, the 13th month was given in July in order to, you know, spur the economy to let people have money to take the vacations and let the tourists and trade survive. Yeah? Then people complained, basically the workers complained, well, that's great. I spent all my 13th on vacation in the summer with my family to the beach. Now I've got no money for Christmas. And they went, oh, we have a crazy idea. How about instead of dividing your paycheck by 13, we'll divide it by 14. And we'll give you one in July, like we have been, and we'll give you one in December.
That's pretty cool.
I mean, it's the same base salary at the end of the year. It's just kind of like you have to think of it like, it's kind of like treating your tax return as a mini savings account. Yeah?
So you get paid once a month?
Except in July and December.
Yeah, no. Wow.
I thought I just made that clear, Dan.
No, I know, but that's weird.
He's a little slow.
No, okay. I'm just saying, that's tough. Once a
month.
Did
I also throw that out there, 26 days of vacation a month? A year.
A month? That'd be awesome. 26 days
of
vacation
a month.
Yeah, that'd
be... no, a year.
What kind of job is that? That's unemployment, man.
Yeah, you don't get the 13th and 14th months if you get 26 holiday days a month.
Hey guys, I'm taking
off. You get 26 days.
Talk to y'all later.
Talk to you later, Al.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank
Good
you.
Night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
That's pretty sweet, though.
I mean, never more, never less, right? Everybody gets it. Plus all patron saint days. So the Catholic holidays.
Wait, everybody in Italy gets 26 days vacation?
Yeah.
That's just standard for everybody?
Good. Yeah.
Wow.
And that's not even the half for Europe, is it? I mean, aren't there some countries get like 45 days or something crazy?
Well, truth, if you look at it on the correct calendar year, where many of the patron saints land in the middle of the week, and we get those days off as bank holidays, and you add the personal vacation that everyone gets, we can, I've seen years here where we had 45 days off.
Okay. Now, what's the work week like? I mean, how many hours a week does the average Italian employee work?
Full-time employee, by labor law, is required to work not less than 32 hours a week and not more than 37.5.
I read something that made me scratch my head. It was broken down by country at length of the work week, and Poland stuck out like a sore thumb amongst all of the, I guess, larger European or that whole region. I think Polish people work the second longest work week in the world. I think America's down there fifth or sixth or seventh, but Poland was the number two longest, which... And you wonder, why are they doing that when everybody around them isn't? But maybe it's an economic thing, I'm sure.
How long is their work week?
And because they're only recently
it's pretty
added
long.
To the EU.
Yeah, it may be.
It's because it's because it's a cultural thing.
pretty kooky.
Very kooky.
Yeah, well, okay, like the French, for example, did you hear about their thing last month?
No.
Okay, so they told the French people that the mandatory retirement age was going to go from, I want to say, it's 55, and they were going to change it to 57. And basically,
rioting in the street.
Everyone went on strike. And when they went on strike, what they did was they pulled in their little their vehicles, they pulled into gas stations all around the country, and just shut off their cars.
Yeah, I saw some of that reported, like, but like, I don't think it was reported like that. It was just like there's unrest and some rioting, but I don't think that kind of
detail. Oh, the rioting was reported. Marginal. It was over exaggerated. No. It was like a sit-in.
Wow.
And basically the entire country shut down. I mean, not some. It wasn't like a minor participation. The entire country shut down.
What did that work out for?
Legislators. Yeah. Yeah. In fairness, the French don't strike often, but when they do, they always get what they want, because while they're striking, they'll say things to the news camera like, remember the Bastille? Remember what happened to the last king that decided to oppress us? And they all kind of, suddenly you have legislators flipping on what they were trying to do very quickly. The French are organized about it. The Italians strike just because, I don't know, the sky's blue today. But they don't really always get what they want out of it, because they do it so casually and nonchalant, and their heart's not really in it.
Wow. That's crazy.
Isn't
That's what we ought to do, politicians here, right? We don't like your policy. Remember what happened? Now, you get arrested for that, though.
Yeah, that's threatening behavior and stuff, right?
Yeah. The French are like, here we come. Bring out the guillotine.
Exactly. Somebody,
that's
bring me my old torch. It's in the back. Who has my pitchfork?
That's pretty wild.
We chase this politician down like Frankenstein. Oh, yeah.
That is pretty wild. Well, with that, I am going to stop this recording now, because it's going on. It's getting lit. Wow, it's almost 3 hours. Well, I might as well just wait for the next 2 minutes.
Off,
what?
Cut this last part off.
People want to hear this. They love this stuff. This is exposing people to other cultures. You really want to lose that?
Well,
Dave Yates didn't even know there existed anything on the other side of the water. For how long, Dave?
I said,
Dave, let's go fishing out in the ocean. And he said, no way, man, we'll fall off the edge of the earth. And I said, Dave, come on, really? He was scared.
Really?
Thought everybody, Dave, on the other side was like Peter 64.
You didn't know. The other side for Peter is really a curtain. Very much like the Wizard of Oz sort of thing.
Curtain.
He really lives in town.
All right, now it's time to shut it off. Happy holidays, everybody. That's right.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Happy holidays.